everybody. It's Dave Player in for Steve Cochran here on the final day of 2015, live from the Allstate Showcase Studios on Chicago's very own 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. You can call, you can text anytime throughout the show this morning. And also joining me this morning, as you just heard, Ms. Veronica Carter. Good morning and Happy New Year to you.
Good morning. It is quite early.
And I should... It is quite early for New Year's, of course. Good, of course. Steve Alexander, good morning to you, sir.
Hey, Dave. Nice to see you.
And Andy Mazur down in the studio.
How's it going?
It's always a different combination of folks we get to hang out with when we do these little fill-ins. So this is nice to hear everybody's voice. So given the fact that we are here this early this morning, who's got big New Year's plans? Like, what are the plans? Ringing in the New Year at 7 tonight?
Oh, yeah. Going to Steve Cochran's New Year's Eve show.
Oh, are you?
Yeah,
which one are you doing?
The 7 o'clock show.
Okay.
Yeah, 3 o'clock seems, you know, that's awfully early.
That might be a little early. Might be a little early for you. How about you, Andy? What do you got going on?
I'm
going
to spend my New Year's with you here tomorrow, so I think my New Year's Eve is going to be spent on the couch and probably falling asleep at some point before it turns midnight, say, in London.
You know, we're going to do a couch potatoes guide to New Year's at about 5:37, so this is perfect for you.
Perfect.
Perfect for you. Veronica, what about you?
Well, I'm here tomorrow morning, too, so if I make it till 9 tonight, it'll be a miracle.
Yeah, Elif, how about you? Are you going to go out and party and just walk in from last night?
No, I'm not one of those people who can handle that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we, you know, we generally do a little vacation. I've got three young kids, 14, 10, and 3. But obviously, with working New Year's, we're going to stay actually down the street. We live in Chicago, but not downtown. So we're going to stay at a little local hotel down here. Probably have dinner around 7. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a little much.
And I was kind of debating what to do tonight, too, about being able to, you know, to come back here in the morning and whether or not it would be okay to drive. I don't live too far, but I'm just saying, you know, to drive here at, you know, 3:30, 4 o'clock, and if it's still going to be amateur hour by then or if that everybody's going to be off the street.
It still might be amateur hour. Steve and I were noticing, though, this morning when we were in the green room, all the police lights and all the security lights that are out here, and you can see the big star right here from the Showcase Studios that's happening with this Chi-Town Rising, the free event that is now, what, $100, $150?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, that changed itself very quickly.
Well, I can tell you, based on the photo that Trib has this morning in the front of the business section, they tested out the star last night, and if you come to Pioneer Court, where it doesn't look like they're going to be able to charge admission right up by the WGN Showcase Studio, you can see it easily as it rises across the river. So.
And you can see Steve and Johnny here in studio.
Yeah, that's right.
The big New Year's show.
New Year's show as well,
absolutely. Here's some basic stats. So a million people, the amount of people expended to attend New York's Times Square ball drop. A billion people from around the world will watch it through Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve. So Jenny McCarthy's actually going to join us this morning.
Dick's not going to be there, is he?
He is not. He is taking the night off. He's taking the night off. Ryan Seacrest, Jenny McCarthy, and Fergie. Those are your big hosts for tonight.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yes, which is, they've been doing it for years already, all of them. Let's see here. To be at the Marriott, it's going to cost you about $3,200 in Times Square to watch the ball drop. Someone, Brian Noonan was talking about this the other day, that, you know, there's a Olive Garden right in the center of Times Square, and to eat at the Olive Garden, so all the soup, salad, and breadsticks you want, $400 a person. because that is the best, probably the best street-level view you will have and be inside.
Wow.
Of a building is at the Olive Garden. I know that's terrible. First year, a lighted ball was dropped in Times Square in 1907. Two times, the ball didn't drop, and they were because of lighting and electrical restrictions during World War II, where they said, we're not going to spend the energy, the time, and so forth on that, which makes sense to me. How many pounds do you think this ball weighs in New York?
What's it made out of?
It's a crystal, Waterford crystal triangles. And it's on a metal structure.
I'm going to say 6,248 pounds.
It's like guessing the bubblegum jar. How about you, Andy?
Boy. A couple thousand?
12,000 pounds.
Okay. So I was about 10,000 pounds.
How much the star weighs? We haven't heard any stats on the star here outside the studio. 2,000 pounds of confetti being dropped in Times Square. Average degrees in New York is 34 degrees. It'll be 19 degrees in New York tonight. 44% of American adults say they will kiss someone at midnight.
Anybody?
any random person. Yeah, I actually remember Jenny McCarthy grabbing like cops and firemen the first year she did it, like randomly on the street, which is a nice place to be. 45% American adults say they will make a New Year's resolution. Of those, 46% are expected to keep them. See, that's the worst. Mm. We're going to have like a life coach in here tomorrow tell us how to keep a New Year's resolution tomorrow.
What are you going to make?
I'm going to swear a little less.
Are you?
On the air.
On the air. Well, that's good. That's a good thing.
You know, that's something, you know, I don't do it in front of the kids, but I notice that my language can get a little salty, and my wife has mentioned that as well, so I'm going to try to curb that back a little bit. 22% of people will be fast asleep before midnight. 360 million glasses of sparkling wine will be served. And it's the 25th anniversary of Janet Davies and Mark Giangreco that'll be making out, around midnight, right, on ABC7. So you can enjoy that as well. It gets a little closer every year.
Noticed.
just a little closer every single year. So there you have it. So here's a quick rundown of what we got on the show today. So after the news at 5:30, we'll talk about some things for Andy to watch since he said he's going to be on his couch.
We're going to do a couch
potatoes guide. To New Year's. Then, you know, it's the time of year on my own show, the Dave Plyer Show, which airs every Saturday night. We share my favorite conversations of 2015, and I don't really call it a best of. That sounds kind of egotistical, best of. But I said to my son, I'm doing my favorite conversations. He said, is that kind of a best of? And I said, yeah. He said, so you don't have anything tonight. Oh, wow. little ball busting.
So from the young man. I see you now why you're trying to swear less.
Exactly. So we've been playing like some of my favorite conversations, and I was going to do one of them this morning just to get a taste of what I do on the weekends. And so Chicago's very own Johnny Galecki, who's a star of The Big Bang Theory, joined me not long ago. So we're going to share that conversation. Later at 6:20, we're going to talk to ABC News about some of the terror threats that are out there right now for some of these New Year's celebrations, not only in the U.S., but overseas as well. So Brad Garrett from ABC News will join us then as well. After 6:37, we'll have a college football bowl preview with Andy and Sam Panionovich and talk about some of the top stories in sports for the year. After the news at 7, we'll talk to Fox News Bill O'Reilly about his new book, Killing Reagan, The Violent Assault That Changed a Presidency. We'll also talk about his pick for the top national news story of 2015. After the news at 7:30, the legendary Walter Jacobson will join us in studio and talk about Chicago, a year in review. Dean Richards will join us at 8, and I'm sure he'll have some updates on the latest on the criminal charges filed against comedian Bill Cosby. Jenny McCarthy from Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve joins us at 8:30. And something we do every single year, our pop culture historians will join us in studio to talk about those we lost in 2015. We break it down by TV, by movies, music, sports, and notable figures. And then this is what we do every New Year's is we invite local restaurants. You know, like some people think New Year's Eve morning, there's nothing available for me to go to dinner. Everything is locked up already. Everything's booked. That's not the case. So to help out our listeners, to help out some of our local businesses, we invite local restaurants to call in, tell us what they're doing for New Year's, maybe a little special offer from WGN, and then get on the air and let people know what's going on for New Year's. So big show ahead. But first, let's take a look at traffic. Laura Vaughn? State Plyer in for Steve Cochran this morning on 720 WGN. So, put together a little couch potatoes guide for New Year's Eve. Now I know it's for Andy specifically.
Yeah, thank you. You must have known I was coming in today.
You're welcome.
Good work.
So, there's the typical New Year's stuff you can watch tonight. And that kind of starts off with Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve. They got like 5.5 hours of content starting at 7 o'clock. And we'll talk to Jenny McCarthy about that at 8:37. But it's like nonstop. Jimmy Buffett, Macklemore. I mean, it's just, there's like Carrie Underwood. It's nonstop for like 5.5 hours of music across the country. So it's going to be fun. 7 o'clock also on Fox, Pitbull's New Year's Revolution. You're a big Pitbull fan, so that would be perfect for you. So we'll do
that. Start the party.
At 7 o'clock. Carson Daly, newly married Carson Daly, has got a New Year special at 9 o'clock at NBC. Donald Trump will be ringing in the New Year on Fox News New Year special, which will be very special,
okay,
I'm sure. And then Anderson Cooper and comedian...
Oh, yeah. Kathy Griffin.
Will be doing the CNN thing as well. But and then there's a Tournament of Roses Parade and all the bowl games that we'll talk about in a little bit. But here's the marathons that are happening that I know are very exciting. There's a Simpsons movie and New Year's marathon on FXX starting at 5 tonight. The animated motion picture kicks off a back-to-back showing of 56 Simpsons episodes.
Wow.
But there's like 600 of them.
Yeah.
So 56 is just
a small percentage.
Scratching the surface a little bit there. Mythbusters. You ever watch Mythbusters? Science Channel or Discovery?
Once in a great while. That's about it.
So every single episode of this series began on Wednesday, December 23rd. It actually ends on January 3rd at 8 p.m. So it's nonstop right now on the Science Channel. Twilight Zone, always a marathon, usually July 4th, Memorial Day, that type of thing. So, you know, sci-fi is doing it again. It's 156 episodes. So every episode, actually.
Wow.
Of this thing. It already began yesterday at 7 p.m. It ends January 3rd at noon. There will be a brief interruption I got from the press release from the Sci-Fi Channel of the WW SmackDown on Thursday from 8 to 10. So the SmackDown New Year special will be on for 2 hours. So there will be a slight interruption for all of you out there.
Cha-ching.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Stars has a Ash versus Evil Dead marathon. Hello. let's see here. The AMC, The Walking Dead, and Fear marathons had already started at 2 o'clock on Tuesday, and that'll keep going. The Mr. Robot marathon on the USA Network. I've never seen this show. It already started. Watch every episode of the first season of Mr. Robot, considered by critics everywhere to be one of the best shows of 2015.
Yeah, it's a good show.
Yeah? Have you watched it?
Yeah.
Tell me, what is it about?
So essentially about a hacker who, it's complicated.
Okay, it's complicated. Go into detail. All right.
But it's well done.
Well done. So you can catch that on the USA Network. Let's see here. Breaking Bad, always a classic. That's on Sundance TV. That started already, so it'll run through New Year's. There's also The Twilight Zone from 2002 that's going to run. So this is the color one. Forrest Whitaker was the host instead of Rod Serling. Be sure to look out for One Night at Mercy, starring Seinfeld's Jason Alexander, The Pool Guy with Lou Diamond Phillips, and The Cradle of Darkness featuring Katherine Heigl on a time-traveling mission to kill baby Hitler. Oh, that sounds like some New Year's fun. That'll be tonight as well on the El Rey Network. Doctor Who. I don't know if you know anybody who's a rabid Doctor Who fan. I've got like a niece and a nephew that can't get enough of this show. So BBC America, it started, it'll start in about 17 minutes. So they're airing all the Doctor Who episodes ever. The Thin Man Marathon on TMC, so Turner Classic Movies. So it's Myrna Loy, William Powell, Thin Man After Thin Man, Song of the Thin Man. Andy, you're not going to know what to do with yourself, my friend.
Yeah. I'm in awe and shock right now. I did admit the other day that during Christmas I got sucked into the marathon of
Christmas
That
Story?
70s Show
on
IFC, and I watched like 6 hours of it.
Oh, my God.
Fun show, though.
It is. We always get stuck watching The Christmas Story over a 12-hour period.
Yeah, over and over and over.
But we never get to see the whole movie in one sitting. So by the time the end of the night's done, we've seen something of that thing as well.
How long do you think you're going to last tonight, you guys?
I may not last much past 11:30 this morning.
I might nap with my 3-year-old about 1 o'clock this afternoon. Dinner's at 7. I said I would stay up at until 10 and wish everybody a happy new year. My kids are like, what? So I don't think they understand I'm getting up at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Well,
but
10 is when Steve and Johnny's Cheap Date Life After Dark New Year's Eve.
See, now that's one thing. You want to talk about New Year's and getting all dressed up and dolled up to go out. You know, you could listen to Steve and Johnny like in your boxers at home. I mean, that's as much as dressed up as you have to get.
I'm actually thinking about crashing that party.
Are you thinking about
sleeping on the desk upstairs in the sports office?
Do we have Blackhawks tonight?
We do.
So they're after the Blackhawks game. Yeah. So you get a little Blackhawks hockey and then a little Steve and Johnny. Mm-hmm. They'll always have great musical stuff in here and all that good stuff. Okay, here's the last one on Encore Classic, which has got to be some random cable channel. The A-Team Marathon. So I pity the fool who's going to watch this thing starting tonight at 7 p.m. Highlights include a guest appearance from Hulk Hogan and Murdoch's Big Win on Wheel of Fortune. I don't even know what they're talking about. And then it is the 25th anniversary of Janet Davies and Mark Giangreco on ABC7. And then, of course, you got Mario Lopez hosting this Star Rising, which, again, we can see outside of the Showcase studios.
Why Mario Lopez?
Well, it's NBC,
he's on that show.
When
right?
you think about Carson Daly doing something and Ryan Seacrest, I guess Mario Lopez is close to that category of hosts.
Yeah, and Saved by the Bell used to be on NBC too. So
that's a random. Okay, all right. Screech, by the way, speaking of Saved by the Bell, did you read about this? He's going to jail. He was arrested for having a gun in Wisconsin, and he's going to be like in Port Washington. Am I right? You live? She's shaking her head. Yes. He's like in, it's up in Wisconsin. So Screech going to prison for like 40 days. Mm. Poor guy. Was not saved by the bell, obviously.
No, sir.
And then again, Steve and Johnny tonight. One of my favorite conversations of the year, The Big Bang Theory's Johnny Galecki. He is from Oak Park. He's from Chicago. We'll do that after a quick look at your morning traffic. Laura? Day Player and for Steve Cochran. So this is the time of year on my show, the Day Player Show, which airs here on 720 WGN every Saturday night. We share my favorite conversations of 2015. And this morning I'm going to share one of my favorites, and that's Chicago's very own Johnny Galecki, star of the number one sitcom in America, and that is The Big Bang Theory on CBS.
Look, if you weren't happy with my presentation, then maybe you should have given it with me.
As I have explained repeatedly, unlike you, I don't need validation from lesser minds. No offense.
Really? So why did you come?
Because I knew you'd screw this up.
I didn't screw it up.
Oh, please. I admit that spherical chicken joke, that was hilarious. But it was straight downhill from there.
You know, I've had enough of your condescension. Maybe I didn't go to college when I was 11, like you. Maybe I got my doctorate at 24 instead of 16. But you are not the only person who is smarter than everyone else in this room. No offense. And I am clearly not the only person who is tormented by insecurity and has an ego in need of constant validation.
So you admit you're an egotist?
Yes! My name is Dr. Leonard Hofstetter, and I could never please my parents, so I need to get all my self-esteem from strangers like you. But he's worse!
Big bang. It all started with a big bang. It's expanding ever outward, but one day it will cause the stars to go the other way. Collapsing ever.
Good morning, it's Dave Player on 720 WGN. So the number one sitcom in America, The Big Bang Theory on CBS, and our guest this morning is the star of this award-winning sitcom, Johnny Galecki. But you also know him from shows like Roseanne, Entourage. He's lent his voice to TV's Family Guy, movies like the perennial favorite National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, Suicide Kings, Vanilla Sky, and so much more. And he grew up right here in Oak Park. And here is Chicago's very own Johnny Galecki. Johnny, what's up, my friend?
Hey, David. How are you? Thanks so much for having me, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for hanging out with us. I wanted to start a little bit from your very beginnings. You were born in Belgium, and I know your dad was in the Air Force station there. When did you make your way to Chicago?
I want to say it was about 2.5 or 3, actually. We lived in he went back to school in Michigan, but we ended up there in Oak Park, I'd say about 4 or 5 years old.
So what do you remember about the city as a kid, besides Mark Giangreco, which you just mentioned to me before the call started?
I did. It was one of my first questions, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Mark Giangreco still around causing trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Mark Giangreco.
That's the first thing on your list.
It was a big change from an Air Force base in Belgium and a big change from living in the sticks out in Allegan, Michigan. So, you know, the fact that there was a fire hydrant outside the house was fascinating, never mind stoplights and what have you.
Yeah. Do you remember, what did you used to do? Did you used to hang out in the city? Did you ever go to Kitty Land? Like, what are some of your fondest memories of being a kid in Chicago?
Oh, we did go to Kitty Land, yes. Yeah, there was quite a bit of, and then my mother had gone to Kitty Land. That was just a statue for that area, certainly.
Since the 1920s, and it closed about three years ago.
At that age, we're talking 4 or 5, just to have a neighbor was a big deal.
Right, But
there was the community that Chicago is, and especially the neighborhoods that Chicago is. There were block parties, there were holiday parties, there was Christmas caroling, which is unheard of nowadays for whatever reason. That all of that started to sink into me, and then later, the Chicago theater community, which was just as supportive as your next door neighbors, was obviously a massive influence on me, and really made it able for me to do what I still do today, 33 years later.
That's very cool. Do you still have friends and family here? Do you visit once in a while?
Yes, all my family is there.
Oh,
yeah,
that's great.
As much as possible.
That's
great. In a few days, as a matter of fact.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And I love it. Even in this time of year, I love it.
Right.
I know it drives people there crazy because they say, you need to deal with it, this weather, for 4 days. We deal with it for 4 months.
Right, exactly. But it's fun to come back here and see it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Fair enough. I get to say, wow, this is really pretty, and they just want to problem me immediately. But it is beautiful there. And those couple those windows, and sometimes they're much too brief of spring and fall, obviously. There's no place I'd rather be.
No.
And outside of those windows, as my mother said, Chicago has two seasons, summer and construction.
Very true.
Winter and construction.
That's totally true. That's totally true. Now, I heard you talk about this before, and I think it was on Letterman. And you know, when you're in a city like this, yeah, everyone gives everyone a nickname. And I had several myself.
True.
Yeah, I had several myself that I...
You know, what are the... Give me a couple of them.
My last name's Plyer. Was
share with the audience.
It was Peeler. It was Pilfer. It was Piler. It was I got a lot of DPs, you know, which also they made fun of. That would be dumb Pollock as well,
win.
Which I
you
am.
Can't really
no.
win.
You can't really win. What was yours?
Well, the one I think that was Conan, where we were talking.
It was Conan.
The Conan at the Chicago Theater there, which was a really thrilling night. My God, I mean. The crowd was, what is this Chicago Theater there hold, like 3,000
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I get nervous still when I do those darn panel shows. Especially at the end of the day, I enjoy surviving them.
Right.
But I'm sleepless for a week before Letterman, for example. And but you walk out on some stage, it's a place like Chicago Theater, and with the history that that place has and the energy of the crowd, you don't have to do much,
but
man. You just
there's always excitement, though.
Their energy wave.
Yeah, we don't see you know, like the big Hollywood stars here in Chicago. So when we see you here and we know you're appearing someplace, we get excited.
Well, I don't. I think that was more for Conan than me. But thank you very much.
You're
but
welcome.
But it was lovely to be able to have my family there in support of one of those things. My great aunt, who was in her 90s at the time, was there. That was a wonderful night. That nickname that we discussed was for me. That was for a couple of years there. It was Bitfingers, which I still have no
bitch fingers. Which
I have no clue why that was the. Why that was the case.
Who gave you that name?
Masculine fingers.
Yeah.
A bartender named Boosh.
Okay, so another guy with another nickname.
There were also many others. As you said, there was, of course, there's the go-lucky or happy-go-lucky or, you know, when you have a name like Johnny, you get a lot of songs sung to you. You get Johnny Good and Johnny Angel, and it's pretty endless.
Yeah, I bet it is. Well, how did you get into acting? Because, I don't think you went to school for it. You were like 11 or 12 when you first got your first gig in a miniseries. How did you get into it?
I started talking about it about the time that we moved there to Chicago. And, you know, my father worked there as a he taught blind veterans at Heinz VA Hospital outside of the city.
Okay.
And my mother was a mother and a housewife. There was nobody in my immediate family that could have been of any influence. I honestly have no idea how I even knew the word actor at 3.5 years old. But that was my answer when adults asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Now, just a couple years later, you know, you landed in what AMC listed this year as the number 2 most favorite holiday movie behind It's a Wonderful Life, if you can believe that. It's Christmas Vacation.
Great?
How cool is that?
Amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing, and it was completely unforeseen. I mean, like I said, my agency at the time, we had started to put me on tape and send it on out. But that was exciting just to know that in itself, to know that someone in Los Angeles, someone in Hollywood was watching my tape, was watching my audition tape. And so the expectations were low. And on that, when I booked the role on Christmas Vacation, I was still living in Chicago. And
oh, okay.
It was that simple situation. They sent in a tape and that I had made, and casting liked it, and they flew me out to Los Angeles, and I read with Chevy Chase and Jeremiah Chesick, the director, and Chevy gave me the role that day. It was really just
wow.
a kind of whirlwind dream come true experience.
I spoke to Beverly D'Angelo before the holidays because it was the 20th anniversary.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, this year. And she was blown away because she said, wait a minute, this beat out White Christmas in Miracle on 34th Street? I feel a little sad for America if they put it number two. But it's a funny, I mean, I got to tell you something. My kids, I guess, you know, my kids are younger. They're 13 and 9 and 2. So the older ones, they want to see Elf and they want to see Christmas Vacation at this age. And Christmas
Story. Sure, I'm sure it's much more relatable to them.
Yeah.
The older films of different generations. It doesn't take away from how brilliant those films are by any means.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think they can just might be a bit more, not to take away from Vacation either.
Yeah.
But it's probably just a bit more relatable to a massive audience right now.
Well, we'll have more with Johnny Galecki, my favorite conversations of 2015 after the news next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer in for Steve Cochran this morning. Every time this time of year, we play my favorite conversations of 2015 on my show, the Dave Plyer Show, every Saturday night. And now my conclusion with one of my favorites, my interview with Johnny Galecki.
Oh, look, honey, our kids are necking.
So, did you guys talk about it?
Yeah, it's cool.
Thank you, Mr. Connor.
All right, well, I guess I'll show you your room in the basement.
I don't think so. First of all, there will be no holding hands. There will be no looks across the room. There will be no touchy-feely. There will be no hanky-panky. There will be no smoochy-woochy. And there will be none of that other stuff you're not supposed to know about.
Can we still date?
If you want, but I don't see much point.
And David, while you live here, you'll be home by curfew. You will keep your room clean. You will be the child we've never had.
Okay, that's fair.
These are just the rules today. We reserve the right to change the rules at any time. For your safety, for your education, or for our amusement.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Johnny Galecki, star of the number one sitcom in America, The Big Bang Theory on CBS. You joined Roseanne in the fourth season, and I would imagine Roseanne was very involved in the audition process because she cast you, you know, in the role of David as Sarah Gilbert's character and Darlene's love interest. That must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, you know, I didn't audition for that. That wasn't a role that Rose or the writers had written, and then they did the kind of traditional orthodox process of reading actors. I had done a television movie with Roseanne called Backfield in Motion. It was only our best work, the two of us. But we hit it off. We played mother and son, and she asked me to come on and do one episode of Roseanne. I had three lines on it and the credit tag, and then she asked me to do three more episodes, and then she asked me to do 3 years, and it turned into almost 100 episodes.
But even back then, your timing, your comedic timing, and I know you do dramatic stuff as well, but I mean, your comedic timing at that age was very entertaining. I mean, it was always funny to watch your character on that show.
Well, thank you. I mean, I you're right. I didn't go to school for it, and I didn't really. In fact, a lot of people at that time suggested to my parents and myself that they not send to any sort of classes, because whatever was happening, you know, was happening. There wasn't a problem at hand, so there wasn't anything to fix, which was, I've always said that I consider myself a comedic actor. It's funny now, I've done so much comedy, I've been so fortunate to do so many comedic projects that people come up to me on the street and ask what comedy club I started in. And I said, oh my God, no, I can't. Oh, I can't imagine. That's a whole different sport. But I would never ever.
But what a compliment! What a compliment, though. You know.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's just funny to me. I mean, I've always felt that, you know, that if it's funny on the page, then you play the honesty of it.
Yeah.
And if there was some unique timing that I had at that age, I think it was really just natural. I mean, I hadn't really come from, you know, my influences were very different than other kids. My influences were not sports figures, or even the other kids in the schoolyard, and it might be, you know, a year or two older than them. They were always the guys in the chorus line I was working with at 7 years old.
Sure.
Or, you know, the actors I had watched and performed scenes with. Or the other, at that point, the comic actors, and some of them legendary, and Chevy Chase and Rick Clayde. And so, I mean, that was just kind of in me in some sort of... those were my heroes.
Yeah, of course
I wanted to emulate them.
Well, you had
but
a great...
I don't know how designed it was as an artist at 10, 11, 12, 13 years old.
That makes sense. And you've done countless movies and TV appearances. And in 2007, you know, not a lot of people can say they have been on two hit television series. And you became the star of one of TV's most successful sitcoms on the Big Bang Theory. And what originally attracted you to the role to do another sitcom?
Honestly, it was the idea that the character would be struggling with love. You know, I haven't gotten many of those roles, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I've played the love interest, best friend, or gay assistant, or something like that.
Right, so right. Yeah.
It was uncharted territory for me to be given that opportunity. And that's why initially, before they had more than a scene or two written, the producers talked to me about doing the role of Sheldon, and I said, you know, I'm kind of much more attracted to this role for this reason. And I'm not saying that, you know, at that time, I certainly didn't know that the Leonard and Penny characters would be successful in the ways of love. But I knew that that's what that character would be struggling with.
But you
and that really attracted to it to me. When you think that way, you have to think best and worst case scenario. You know, you could be doing this for a number of years, playing this role. And it's going to need to be something that is going to be fun and interesting and challenging.
Yeah, I was going to say, as an actor,
every week for what could be a decade of your life.
That's what I have to think. Yeah, that's what I have to think is that, you know, as an actor, you want something
being
that's not...
being self-protective. Yeah. I mean, there chances are that you're not going to be... But I knew that if that was the case, then that would have me galvanized to do the best job, to give it 110% every day.
It is a funny, funny show, and it's in its eighth season. The audience continues to grow, 18 million plus viewers per week, and the writing is consistently good, and that is also rare, especially for a series in its eighth season. I only feel like it's in the beginning. Like I don't feel like this is like, oh, they're in their eighth season already. It's hot in syndication, and I was looking at this too. Number one comedy on all of cable. It's even on the reruns. When you're on like TBS, this show does better than some of the first run stuff. Not only on cable, but on broadcast television. That's pretty incredible.
It is, and I mean, all I do is just kind of pinch myself and be grateful and be in awe of that because, you know, like I said, it's nothing that anyone could predict or design, and there's no recipe for it. I mean, even as successful as Chuck Lorre is, I think he's just as thrilled and humbled by it as anyone else. You know what you think is funny and appealing, and you love your characters, and and you hope that people outside the soundstage feel the same way.
Big Bang Theory airs every Thursday at 7 Central on CBS. Still number one in his game. Johnny, absolute pleasure spending some time with us.
Take care.
All right. All right, let's take a quick look at your morning traffic, Laura. All right, it's Dave Plyer in for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN. So it's become somewhat of a cliche as we discuss security concerns in regards to New Year's Eve celebrations in New York's Times Square, but the terror threat has evolved to include soft targets, venues that are not nationally known, and for that matter, packed with thousands of people. And joining us this morning with the very latest is ABC News correspondent Brad Garrett. Brad, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So here we are on New Year's Eve. You can see this coming a mile away, that we'd be talking about security concerns on New Year's. And while most of the focus involves, you know, extreme terrorist groups, the long-feared homegrown threat that appears, you know, has finally come to fruition here, not to mention simply misguided individuals with violent intentions and the ability to get their hands on a gun. What are we seeing right now?
Well, you're seeing law enforcement in numbers increase who will be out tonight, both in uniform and undercover. You'll see, or not, more federal agents working tonight, because this is really driven, and you came up with a great example of this is not just ISIS. This is folks that have other sort of bents to harm people for whatever reason could be floating around tonight. And so it's all driven by what intelligence you have and how they can get in front of people. It's the, you know, it's the nightmare like San Bernardino, Paris twice this year that they didn't know about. And so that's what's got law enforcement scrambling to see, can they cover every base? But, you know, we're only as good as the public makes us in law enforcement. And so it's really key for people to keep reporting.
Well, and those are two perfect examples. And we're talking Paris, San Bernardino, two completely different locales. And, you know, San Bernardino not being a major, major metro area, this could happen anywhere. Bill Bratton, the police commissioner for New York, said there's going to be about 6,000 police officers around Times Square, and as you said, undercover as well. Federal and local security officials are tightening security in high-profile locations, including New York, the Rose Bowl festivities, another specificity in Los Angeles. The stage is set here tonight, just across the river here at from our studios at the Hyatt. We're expecting about 10,000 people, and I know the city of Chicago is ready for that as well. We've noticed additional cameras also outside the plaza and along the river as well. But this is not only in the U.S. I mean, obviously, Brussels are so rocked by its recent terror troubles, their New Year's festivities have been canceled.
Correct. And here is the issue. When you tighten security, which obviously we have to do at events like your fireworks, the Rose Bowl, there's a term called displacement, and what it means is then do we displace the bad guys to some softer place? That might be the case, and unfortunately, ISIS in particular apparently likes softer targets. So a big concern, the bottom line is there's only so much you can do when you have large crowds gathering that aren't screened, which obviously you can't screen people going to the fireworks. So we're going to hope that we've got the intelligence and nothing big happens tonight.
And what security measures and tools are being deployed? I mean, besides people and men and women on the street, what else are we looking at here?
Well, you're going to have in many jurisdictions, my guess Chicago, additional dogs sniffing for potential bombs. There'll be license plate readers. They'll have those out because you want to capture basically the movement of cars in and around these events, of which will probably be dumped in short order if nothing happens tonight. My sense would be that they'll use drones of some sort to give them better coverage. And I guarantee you they'll have extra people on duty monitoring whatever camera system you have in Chicago on the streets to see if they can get in front of something they see.
Now, we talked about Brussels a little bit. I know Turkish police said they've arrested two people with alleged ISIS ties on suspicions of planning a bombing attack in Turkey's capital on New Year's Eve. Austria, we're seeing something else. There's a heightened security in Vienna after police said that there's several European cities that warned of a possible terror attack. And the U.S. Embassy in Bangladesh warned U.S. citizens this week that attacks against hotels and clubs are possible in the capital of Dhaka as well. So this is really happening around the world.
It is. It's not just an event here. And as we talked earlier, I think it's just something that's just not going to go away. It's sort of the new reality.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on this throughout the day and evening. Brad Garrett with ABC News. Happy New Year to you. Be safe.
Same to you. Take care.
All right. News coming up next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer in for Steve Cochran this morning on 720 WGN. So big sports weekend ahead, kicking off with some of the biggest college bowl games like the Cotton Bowl, the Rose Bowl, the Sugar Bowl. And joining us to break it all down in the top stories in sports, Chicago sports of 2015, are my pals Andy Mazur and Sam Pandianovich. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Sam, how you doing?
Andy, you made it back from Lincoln. I was worried. We saw the snow, and I thought, uh-oh, yeah, Sam, I hope he makes it back.
Sam and I were texting yesterday during the day. He says, am I going to get a call at 11 o'clock tomorrow night?
Sam was here. It looked like he was here for 24 hours straight when I came in here yesterday morning.
He's a hardworking young guy. Come on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sam, how are you today, buddy?
I'm good. It's funny. I was so tired when I responded to your email. You said, give me three bowls to talk about. I thought we were doing this New Year's Day, so I forgot the two big games, the Orange Bowl and of course, the Cotton Bowl. So we should probably talk about the Final Four, too, if we have time.
We will do that as well. But let's kick this off with the top three sports stories in Chicago for 2015. I think two are easily identified. One would be the Blackhawks championship season, taking the cup home once again.
Yeah, and it was something that I was actually to experience firsthand this time. You know, in 13, I had just started at the station, so I was in the studio most of the time. I was covering this playoff run, you know, firsthand for most of it. I was at all the home games and, you know, got to spend time on the ice after they won. It was just such a great ride. And, you know, to see the end of the Patrick Sharp era, you know, they traded Johnny Oduya. They made a lot of moves, you know, Antoine Vermette and Brad Richards and a lot of these guys. I think they got rid of 8 or 9 players.
Yeah.
But, you know, the accumulation of this team, winning their third Stanley Cup in 6 seasons, you know, Jonathan Tibbs on the ice with his mother, just embracing on the ice. You had Patrick Kane and his family and Corey Crawford and his family. And just, you know, you knew that there was going to be a big shakeup, but this team was able to put that sort of on the back burner and figure out a way to win their third cup in 6 years. And, you know, Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook and Nick Chalmerson and, I mean, just a great group of players and maybe one of the better coaches that we've seen in the last, I don't know, 30 years with Joel Quenneville. It's the perfect blend, the perfect group, and the willingness to, you know, put the team first and win that Stanley Cup. It was just an amazing ride.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, it was kind of personal, too, because in 2010 and 2013, I was living out of town, and I was the only person, I think, was living and breathing in Southern California that was supporting the Blackhawks. And I had to walk around the streets of San Diego with my Blackhawks jerseys on. And this year, I actually got to celebrate with some friends. We were at a local watering hole, and it was a great experience. And what Sam said, I mean, this is a special group of people and a special group of hockey players. Plus, you throw into the mix Quenneville and the assistant coaches and Stan Bowman and the job that he's done trying to put this thing back together again with the salary cap.
But the Hawks saying, you know, bidding farewell like Saad, Sharp, Oduya. It was hard seeing Sharpie with the Stars last week. It was tough watching him on the ice.
Yeah, especially when he knocked the goal stick out of Corey Crawford's hand.
Exactly. You don't want to see that stuff. Patrick Kane put an emotional offseason behind him and jumped out to one of the best starts of his career, earning at least a point in 26 consecutive games.
I mean, Sam, you saw most of that. I mean, it's just an amazing thing to think that this guy was able to do what he did going through what he did in the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, right now he's got 53 points in, I think, 36 games. He is second in all of hockey with 22 goals. He's second in assists. He's got 31. And, I mean, we talked about this on the beat last week, Andy. I mean, when he's got the puck, you've got at least 2 or 3 sets of eyes on him. You know, everybody knows what he can do with the puck, yet he's still able to do what he wants to do. You know, defense is trying to throw the kitchen sink at him. And if you overload on Patrick Kane, he's going to find somebody wide open, whether it's Panarin or Anisimov or a sliding defenseman right at the net. I mean, he's so aware with the puck, so special. And he's really developed into a complete two-way player. It's not just offense anymore. He can take it away from you better than anybody, too.
But the NHL's leading scorer, you know, seeking to become the first U.S.-born player to win the Hart Trophy for league MVP and the Art Ross Trophy awarded annually to the player who records the most points during the regular season. That's some pretty cool stuff right there.
It's cool, and I think, you know, just to kind of add on to what Sam was just saying, too, I mean, you think about what he went through, and now you think about the complete hockey player that he's become. I mean, it's showing a mature attitude, at least on the ice. Let's put it to you that way. I mean, he's kind of grown as a hockey player right before our eyes because, you know, originally he was all offense. It was showtime, and that was really all it was about. But now he's creating some of his opportunities by playing good two-way hockey.
He's really a terrific guy, too. We see him often in my neighborhood at the Gale Street Inn, a little rib joint on Milwaukee Avenue, and he's there. He's there with his parents, girlfriend, whatever it might be. And people are very respectful when he is there. Like, they don't come up to him, but they might give him a little wave. He always comes down, says hello to the kids and stuff while he's having a little dinner. But good guy, too. So I'm glad things have worked out for him. Second, I would say, would be the Cubs in the playoffs. 97 regular season wins and the third best record in baseball.
Nobody saw that one coming. I mean, I think people, and Sam, I think you'll agree with me, we've talked about this before as well, that, you know, maybe it was this year that was supposed to be the time that they kind of gelled and maybe made a run for the division title and got into the playoffs. And I just think that there was some beautiful ignorance, if you will, with these young players just not knowing any better, that they weren't supposed to do what they were doing last year. It does raise the bar quite a bit for the upcoming season, and the front office has tried to address some of the holes that were there. But I think any time you go to the playoffs and you beat the Cardinals and you're a Cub fan, I think life is good.
Yeah, if it wasn't for a guy named Daniel Murphy, they're probably in the World Series.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
That guy had one of the most incredible playoff runs. I mean, he pretty much single-handedly slugged the Mets into the World Series. And that's something that I think, you know, you don't see very often. I mean, who knows who Daniel Murphy is, you know, before this season. But you look back at what the Cubs were able to accomplish. I mean, they won the Rookie of the Year award, the MVP, the Cy Young, the Manager of the Year. I mean, that was Arrieta and Bryant and Joe Maddon. And this was, you know, like Andy said, sort of ahead of schedule. Now you had Jason Hayward, you had John Lackey and Bet Zobrist. This team is actually well seasoned for, you know, being so relatively young. I mean, a lot of these guys were in the minor leagues in the last 1 or 2 years. So ahead of schedule, but now the narrative starts to change, Dave. Now they're expected to go farther. And, you know, you don't get slack. You know, if you go to the first round and you lose, then people are going to wonder, well, what the heck happened? Because you went to the NLCS last year. So now you have to play with pressure. And this is something that I don't think they've had to do in a long time on the north side, maybe back to 07, 08, when you're expected to win, expected to make the playoffs. Now these young, cuddly Cubs are expected to do more, and we'll see what happens.
Plus, we've got, you know, this new fan experience at the field, too. Mm-hmm. And, Andy, I know you send in a lot of pictures I see online all the time about what's happening. The, you know, if you've gone by Wrigley Field lately, the marquee is gone. The entire front looks...
The front door is wide open.
It's completely bizarre to see, but all the construction going on. But inside the field, you know, as much as I thought, okay, this Jumbotron dwarfs the original scoreboard, that bothered me a little bit. It does change, especially when you're bringing kids to a game. It does change the fan experience considerably.
Yeah, I was a little hesitant, a little worried about what they were going to actually do on that video board. I was not going to be okay with kiss cam, muscle cam, dance cam, those kind of stupid things that I see everywhere else. I think it's been tastefully integrated into the fabric of what it's like to watch a game at Wrigley.
What would be the number three sports story? And I know both of you have different opinions on this, Sam.
I would say it's the Bulls firing Tom Thibodeau to bring in Fred Hoiberg, because it's still something, and if you watched the game last night, you still are concerned about the decision. You look back and think, well, would this team be better with Tom Thibodeau? I think they would be. I think they'd be playing every night. You wouldn't be battling with inconsistency, but what's done is done. And, you know, a college coach, Fred Hoiberg, comes in and is still trying to learn his way with these professional players. He was called out by Jimmy Butler in his first season, 25 games in, that, you know, he wasn't doing things right and wasn't holding players accountable. So I think it's just fascinating. This whole Bulls thing has been really interesting to me, because you've got Derrick Rose, who can't stay on the floor. Joakim Noah is battling injuries. Jimmy Butler wants to be the leader, even though other players don't think he's the leader yet, which is, you know, so weird. There's so many interesting dynamics with this club. But, I mean, Tom Thibodeau took the Bulls to the playoffs 5 years in a row, and they cut him. I mean, they sent him away. They paid him not to coach. So, you know, for me, that's my third biggest story, even though it's probably not the most successful story. It's certainly one of the most interesting ones.
Big headlines. Andy?
I kind of went back and forth. I was debating between the Bears hiring John Fox, because that meant there was no more Mark Trestman. I think that's a big story. But I kind of went deeper into the whole thing and thought about some of the guys that we lost this year, and that was Ernie Banks and Mitty Minoso. Pretty much, you know, the iconic figures of each of those franchises passed away in the same year. And it was very interesting to watch when the Cubs Sox series was going on at Wrigley Field. All the Cubs players had the 69 jerseys on, with all of them wearing the number 14. And then when the series moved to U.S. Cellular Field, they all the White Sox players all wore number 9 for Mitty Minoso. So I thought that was a pretty big story this year.
Well, stick around. We're going to look at the bowl games today and through the weekend with Sam Panionovich and Andy Mazur after a look at your traffic trouble spots. Now, Nothing like a little Frank Pellico to wake you up in the morning. It's Dave Leonard for that. Steve Cochran on 720 on WGN. And we're talking about the top Chicago sports stories of 2015 and a bowl game preview with Sam Panayanovich and Andy Mazur. So 12 bowl games ahead before the national championships that are on Monday, January 11th, the final game. Today's the Chick-fil-A Bowl, Houston versus Florida State. We got the Orange Bowl coming up.
Yeah, and that's one of the national semifinal games with the new college football playoff system, and that's going to have Oklahoma, which is the number 4 team, against the number 1 Clemson. And the winner of that game and the winner of the Cotton Bowl between Michigan State and Alabama will meet in the desert in Glendale for the national championship on the 11th of January. So it's interesting. I mean, I really enjoy this time of the year with the fact that the college football the universities, the presidents, the ADs finally got together and realized that there was some, not only some money to be made for a playoff, but it was also kind of would draw fans and it would draw a lot more interest into
entertainment.
It, I think, you know,
absolutely. Cotton Bowl Classic also tonight, and that's Michigan State versus Alabama.
Yeah, so that's the second semifinal matchup. So that's it's important. I mean, it's. That's an interesting matchup, too, because, you know, Michigan State and Alabama, there's some coaching history there between D'Antonio and Saban. And D'Antonio says that he's learned a lot from Nick Saban. And that'll be another interesting little sideline there. And Michigan State really earned its way there. I mean, they rolled through Iowa in the Big Ten championship game. And, yeah, Iowa hadn't lost a game yet.
Sam, you're back on Outback Bowl is obviously tomorrow and on 720 WGN, Northwestern versus Tennessee.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, Dave, I should tell your listeners that you told me if I predicted any of these games wrong, I couldn't come back next year.
So
I've been crunching numbers pretty much all day.
Good work.
You know, this is interesting because, and I hope Dave Hennett's listening, he doesn't fire me, but, you know, Northwestern hasn't really played, you know, they missed a lot of the big boys in the Big Ten. They didn't play Ohio State. They didn't play Michigan State. And of the two big teams they did play, Michigan and Iowa, they lost by a combined 78-10. So, you know, I'm skeptical of their ability to play in big games. This team is still sort of ahead of schedule. You know, they have a freshman quarterback in Clayton Thorson, I believe a sophomore running back in Justin Jackson. The defense is good, but I'm worried about this offense, which has been a little anemic at times, playing against a team from the SEC that has a lot of speed. You know, Thorson has been a guy who's been able to take off and, you know, bust out 40, 50-yard runs. Don't think that happens against Tennessee. So they're going to have to find ways to bust out the trickery and see if Pat Fitzgerald can't dial up some good plays to kind of keep Tennessee off balance. It should be close, but whichever quarterback, whether it's Josh Dobbs for Tennessee or if it is Clayton Thorson for Northwestern, whichever one is able to make the big plays in the second half, that team's probably going to win the game.
See, I was kind of thinking earlier in the game, and just to get your thought about this too, because I'm wondering if it wouldn't be better to get Thorson really involved early to try to get the confidence going, or if it would be more prudent to try to establish a good ground game against Tennessee's defense, kind of keep them on the field a long time, and then see what Thorson can do once they kind of wear him down.
Yeah, and I've also heard this angle that Northwestern feels a little snubbed, you know, that they felt like they should have been in the college football playoff. But both of these teams are going to try and win this football game. You know, when you get to New Year's Day, New Year's Eve, and beyond, these teams are all here for the same reasons. They're good football teams. They deserve to be here. And, you know, it's not like, you know, Northwestern or Tennessee. I don't think either team is going to lay an egg. So they're both motivated. You can't really use that card on either side. I do think, well, like I said, I think Tennessee is the stronger team on paper. You know, even though Northwestern is ranked higher, Tennessee is almost a 9-point favorite in Las Vegas. And that pretty much tells you everything you need to know about this game.
Exactly. Yeah. And you got the Fiesta Bowl. You got Notre Dame versus Ohio State. The Rose Bowl, Stanford versus Iowa. It's going to be a big game tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, Iowa, the only loss they had, as I mentioned, was in the Big Ten championship game there against Michigan State. If it weren't for a 22-play drive at the end, you know, Iowa would be probably in the college bowl, the championship situation. But, you know, Stanford is that that team, Sam, that that Northwestern got in the first game of the year, and Stanford really kind of went on a roll from there. I mean, they kind of righted their ship and had it sailing in the right direction.
Yeah, and the only loss that they had after Northwestern was the game against Oregon, after Oregon started to figure it out late this season. I actually watched the Big Ten Championship at the Playa residence. So, you know, Dave, you and I both kind of saw Iowa try to bend but not break on that last. I think it was a 22-play drive that Michigan State put together to break the backs of Iowa. They're still one of the better defenses in the country. I just hope that, you know, the wind didn't completely come out of their sails, because oftentimes when you're undefeated and you have your eyes on the big prize and you do lose in that final game in sort of devastating fashion, you worry about the bounce back. So, you know, Stanford could certainly, you know, bust the doors off of Iowa in this one. I'm a little worried for the Big Ten, the Rose Bowl.
Then you got the Sugar Bowl, Oklahoma State versus Ole Miss on Saturday. You got Penn State versus Georgia in the Tax Slayer Bowl. You got Kansas State and Arkansas at the AutoZone Liberty Bowl. I love all these sponsorships. The Valero Alamo Bowl, Oregon versus TCU, the Motel 6 Cactus Bowl. That's a good one.
Yeah, there's so many bowls. Yeah. You know, one that we haven't really touched on yet, I think, is interesting. You've got Notre Dame against Ohio State.
Yeah.
And Urban Meyer with the Buckeyes. As a head coach, has always sort of figured out ways to get his team ready for bowl games. I mean, with Ohio State last year, they won the Sugar Bowl and then won the national championship. Actually, as a coach in his career in bowl games, he's 9-2, which is pretty good. So I think he'll have his team ready. But it's interesting because that team has sort of a divide in the locker room between quarterbacks. So don't sleep on Notre Dame. Notre Dame is certainly an upset special for a lot of smart people. I think the Irish keep it really, really close.
All right, and then we've got the finals coming up, obviously, too, in the college football playoff national championship, and that's going to be in Glendale, Arizona on January 11th. So we'll see what happens there.
Andy, who do you got winning it all? I think it's going to be Oklahoma and Alabama, and I think big game Bob Stoops wins his national championship. I think the Sooners are going to take it all.
Yeah, see, I had Michigan State getting the upset against Alabama and then Oklahoma. I thought Oklahoma was playing the best football probably of any of those teams coming toward the end. Well, maybe with the exception of Michigan State. I'd love to see that championship game, but I do agree with you. I think Oklahoma's going to win it all.
Oh, that means it's not going to happen.
That means it's going
not going to happen.
You know what that means? That means Clemson's going to win the title.
Pretty much.
All right, pull out your crystal balls. I want to see where you think we're going to be with the Hawks and the Cubs this year. How are we going to end the season? How are we going to kick this off on both teams? Andy?
I think the Cubs will probably, you know, they're going to win the division, I think, this year. I think they've weakened themselves. They've weakened the Cardinals just by getting Lackey and Hayward. I think they'll win the division. I don't really have a good feel yet for how far they will go in the playoffs. And I think the Hawks are just kind of coasting right now and getting ready to fire it up come February and March. And that's a team, as Sam and I discussed the other day, you don't want to play them at that time of the year because they figure out a way to get things done.
They do. Sam?
I think they both make the playoffs, and for all the vitriol thrown the Hawks' way for, you know, being in third place in the Central, fourth place in the West, this team is primed. I mean, why can't they go to the Western Conference Final again with that roster? And the hockey's like roulette, Dave. Look at the numbers they have, 19, 88, 81. They've got 2 and 7 and 50 and 86 and 65. They can go to the Western Conference Final, and when they get there, who knows?
Well, again, the Outback Bowl is on tomorrow at 10, Northwestern, here on 720 WGN with Dave Ennett. And Happy New Year to you both.
Right back
at you, Dave.
All right. Thanks, gents. News is next, 720 WGN. State player and for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN. So Bill O'Reilly's fifth book in his Killing series, after bestsellers Killing Lincoln, Killing Kennedy, Killing Jesus, and Killing Patton, is Killing Reagan, the violent assault that changed a presidency. Bill O'Reilly's The O'Reilly Factor, now in its 20th year, has been the most watched cable news show for the past 15 years, and he is a history buff at heart. One of the busiest guys in the business, please welcome back to the program, Bill O'Reilly. Bill, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me in, Dave.
Absolutely. So together, you and Martin Dugard, who is also a New York Times bestselling author and researcher of several books of history, is your co-author on these books, Lincoln, Patton, Kennedy, Reagan. What has prompted you to turn your investigative eye towards the world's most prominent historical figures?
Well, I'm very distressed as an old history teacher. I used to teach kids in a slum of Miami way back. That history is not taught in many, many public schools anymore, and urchins just don't know anything about it. So I decided to write books that were fun to read, but taught you about your country or about World War II, whatever it may be. And the combination has worked great. I'm now the biggest-selling nonfiction author in the world. And there's a hunger for this kind of knowledge, as long as it's packaged in a way that it's entertaining to read.
I agree with you that there's a fundamental disconnection in the schools with the depth of history that's taught. I have a 14-year-old, I have a 9-year-old, and I have a 3-year-old. But the two older ones, they've barely skimmed the surface of some of the history lessons that I see them bring home. And your books are entertaining as well as they are real history. Now, let's talk about the new book, Killing Reagan. There were clearly other presidents who were assassinated, like President McKinley and Garfield. Why the failed assassination of President Reagan?
Well, because, number one, I don't think many Americans know anything about Ronald Reagan. They know the myth. They don't know the man. So I wanted to write about who he is or who he was and why and how he attained greatness, because I do think he was a great president. And the story is fabulous because he starts off as a real shallow guy out in Hollywood as an actor. And then he has this unbelievable evolution, finally gets to the White House, and then he almost dies. So there's so many twists and turns. It's just a terrific story to tell. And it's also germane to now, because when he became president in 1980, the country was a lot like it is now in the sense that the economy was terrible. And overseas, we were taking a beating under President Carter. And he marched in and changed that. It wasn't easy to change it, but he did. So there was a lot of relevancy and it was a lot of curiosity on my part to know more about Reagan, and I think we accomplished that.
Now, these books, like all of your books, are pretty unfiltered. So if you're true fans of Ronald Reagan, like your other books, you provide the good, the bad, and the ugly. So it's a truer portrait of one of America's most respected leaders.
And people don't like that. Some people don't like it. You know, the controversy about Killing Reagan centers about a meeting that absolutely happened, where in 1987, Howard Baker took over as chief of staff after Donald Reagan was fired. And there were rumors in the White House that President Reagan had lost control of the administration. And Baker brought his guy in, James Cannon. They had a big investigation, and Cannon presented a written report that said, yes, on some days, Ronald Reagan's so disengaged that he doesn't even come down to work. He watches soap operas. And we reported that in the book. And some Reagan people didn't like that. They didn't want it reported. And so there was this big thing with George Will and his crew.
Right,
it's all coming out of one, one little hopper. Out in California, they all know each other, and they don't want this to be out there. But we proved it 15 different ways, and I'm not going to back off from those people. So they attacked me, I struck back, and we had a lively debate.
Yeah, so when you talked about Reagan and watching the soap operas, that was kind of a break for him, really, because he needed it. He needed to breathe a little bit.
Well, what happened was, in 87, he basically went into a downward spiral. Nobody really knows why. It was Iran-Contra. Everybody remembers that name, but they don't really know what happened. And he had accomplished a whole bunch of things. He had won re-election, beaten Mondale, but something wasn't right. And then after he understood that things were going south, because Iran-Contra is a serious threat to him, he rallied, and Baker saw that, and we reported that in the book, that he was at a nadir, but then he rallied, and then he had some of his greatest achievements, like the speech at the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it's an amazing story of ups and downs.
Well, and a lot of the structure of this book surrounds what was called the Cannon Memo, written by a close friend of Reagan's named James Cannon. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's what I was mentioning, that the Baker brought Cannon in, and Cannon did the investigation, and a lot of the things that he found out were disturbing. Now, Baker himself didn't really buy into the fact that Reagan was incompetent or that Reagan was damaged. Baker didn't believe it, and we report that. But the memo existed, and it said things like, sometimes a president is so disengaged that other people sign his name to documents. And the New York Times actually reported that in James Cannon's obituary in the 90s. So all of this is fact.
Yeah, yeah.
And for people to refute it and to say, oh, it's been, you know, it's been proven to be incorrect and all that, it's that's just a lie. I mean, what Will is putting out there was such a falsehood. And here's the kicker. That Cannon memo has disappeared. Now, Dugard and I, when we were writing the book, we didn't even think that was going to be a big controversy because it was attested to by Ron Reagan, the president's son, by Michael Deaver, the president's best friend. All of these people said, yeah, it happened. So we didn't even think this was going to be controversial. So we didn't look for the memo itself because we had reports of it. But then after all of this came out, we started to look, yeah. And it's gone. Somebody took that memo and either hid it or destroyed it. It's not in the Reagan Library. It's not in Baker's papers. It's not in Cannon's papers. It's where is it? And that's big. That's a big thing.
But what this memo says and what this story really tells, you've kind of defined differently the word assassination or killing when it comes to Reagan, because what it did is it changed who he was as a human being along the entire route of his presidency.
Well, also, though, if you believe the Mayo Clinic doctors that examined Reagan every year, the wounds that he suffered under Hinckley's barrage of bullets did hasten his death. So I think that the killing moniker works there. That hasn't been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a matter of conjecture and opinion by some medical people. But they do believe that the president, the trauma at age 70 that he went through really affected him physically and mentally throughout his whole life.
Well, we're talking to Bill O'Reilly, and coming up, a look at the year in review. Player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Bill O'Reilly, host of the O'Reilly Factor on the Fox News Channel, about his new book, Killing Reagan, and the year in review. Now, like all the books in the series, you're building the subject through a series of events. It's not necessarily chronological, but it places you in the path of history. And the very first chapter focuses on the debate of 80 between Reagan and Carter. When he said, you know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Did that pretty much knock him into the presidency?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Reagan was a very skilled presenter of facts, and that was his acting talent. So he, both times, with Carter and Mondale, won the election based upon his debate performances, because both times he was in a little bit of peril as the election became closer. And so we walk you through that, and you made a very astute point. These are not biographies of Ronald Reagan, all right? These are points of view about events that happened in Reagan's life, Kennedy's life, Jesus, all of that. They're not biographies. And this is what, you know, in the criticism of these books, what you left out. Did George Shultz the other day in the New York Times, well, you didn't talk about arms reduction. And I'm going, I don't even think Shultz read the book. Why would I talk about arms reduction in a book called Killing Reagan, where we're looking at the man?
Right.
Doesn't have to do with his policies. So, you know, if you don't get it by this time, you're never going to get it. This is the fifth in the series, as you mentioned. And we're very proud of these books. They are true top to bottom.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead to what you write about in October 80, a time where you say losing the election may have saved Jimmy Carter's life. So well put, because an unstable John Hinckley was out to impress actress Jodie Foster at any cost. And Jimmy Carter was on the list. I think people don't understand this. President Reagan wasn't the first person on this guy's list to shoot.
President Reagan wasn't on his list at all.
Yeah,
he stalked Carter he went to Tennessee to try to kill Carter. Hinckley did. And he couldn't get close to him. And then he went to Washington, D.C. a short time later, and he was sitting in a Holiday Inn, and he was reading the Washington Post. And in the Washington Post, there was a headline that said, Ronald Reagan is speak to a labor union at the Hilton Hotel. That's when Hinckley decided to kill Ronald Reagan.
And
right
then. Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't a plan like Oswald. It wasn't that. It was a spontaneous act because of this madman wanting to impress an actress. And so he got his coat on, he put his gun in his pocket, he walked over to the Hilton Hotel and he shot him.
And you provide in great detail the moments leading up to the assassination attempt from both timelines revolving both Reagan and Hinckley. Always fascinating. He shot, thrown into the car. And I don't think people really understand that he was truly near death. He came out of it. He came out with the smiles. He waved at the crowds and everything. But he was in really, really bad shape. I mean, he was really almost at the end of his life at that point.
Right. Doctors thought he was going to die. And if he hadn't been so robust physically, because Reagan was a big man and he did a lot of riding and a lot of wood chopping and he was in good shape for his age, he would have died. And a lot of people just have no idea how close that happened. And then a few weeks later, he appears in his jammies with Nancy and he's waving and his hair looks great and everybody breathes a sigh of relief. The president is back. But he really wasn't back, and that's the crux of the book.
And I know you have an opinion on this, but I had a colleague of mine, actually one of my early mentors, have open-heart surgery. And afterwards, he was really never the same. There was memory loss. And
how could you be?
No. And
you know, especially at that age, you couldn't be. That's why, I mean, you know, when Dugard and I write these books, we take this seriously. I mean, we don't write these books, in a fast way. This is a methodical process where we're bringing information to people that they don't know. And that's why the books are so successful.
Concerns went way beyond his presidency. 93, you talked about when Reagan was celebrating his 82nd birthday with Margaret Thatcher. And at that point, it was very clear he was failing. Just 1 year later, he announced he had Alzheimer's. And you talk about the relationship between Ronald Reagan and his wife, Nancy, and over the course of his presidency, there were several layers of Nancy that transformed her from the early days of the presidency to the end of her life. But she was at his side to the very end. I mean, she was loyal to him.
Yeah, I mean, the evolution of Nancy Reagan is almost as startling as the evolution of Ronald Reagan. At first, she's a striver. She goes from the Midwest, Chicago, to L.A. to try to marry a rich, famous person. And she succeeds. She marries Ronald Reagan. And then the politics start, and Reagan gets elected governor, and she becomes the First Lady of California, and then a First Lady of the United States, and becomes imperious. Most people despised her. By all accounts, she was rude and fierce in protecting her husband, but alienated almost everybody. But then, after her husband leaves the White House and becomes ill, she becomes a hero. She was a primary caregiver. Most people, you know, farm that out or hire people to do that. Not her.
Yeah, she was it.
Yeah, she slept with Reagan up until his death in the same bed when he was delirious. So that story is another story that people don't know. And, you know, at the end of the book, Nancy Reagan emerges as a true hero. And I dedicated the book, Killing Reagan, to all the caregivers who work with loved ones and the elderly and are loyal to the end, because those are extraordinary people.
Another terrific book, Bill. Another new number one New York Times bestseller. What else is in the works? Because you always have something in around the corner.
Yeah, we got three more killing books to deliver. We got the Reagan movie, which will be in next October. So I'm working on that, making sure that the screenplay is where it should be. We signed for the Killing Patton movie, which will be the biggest television movie of all time, most expensive. And then we are writing the next book, which will be out in September. And I can't say what it is because then other people steal the idea. But there's a lot of action in this book. And it's, again, something that everybody's heard about, but nobody really knows about. And so we're having a good time doing it, Dave.
Before I let you go, it's a time where everyone looks back at the year behind us. To you, what was the top story of 2015? There's ISIS, the presidential race, Benghazi, gun violence in America, Planned Parenthood. Kanye and Kim have another baby, Bill. What's the big story?
I think the story of 2015 is the collapse of the Obama administration. The poll last week said 20% of Americans feel the USA is on the right track. 20%.
Yeah.
That is an amazing statistic. And the president, you know, he's a controversial guy. He had 7 years to turn it around, and only 20% of people feel that he's done it. So that's the big story of 2015.
And a look at the year ahead, who do you think will be facing each other in the race for president? Where do you think
it's going to be? Can't say on the Republican side. It's way too chaotic because of the Trump factor. We've been doing a lot of coverage on that and a lot of interviews with him.
Yep.
He's blown up the system, and so it's not the way it used to be now, and we really don't know how that's going to come down.
Well, you can see Bill O'Reilly in The O'Reilly Factor Monday through Friday in the Fox News Channel and check out his latest book, Killing Reagan, The Violent Assault That Changed a Presidency. And for that, you can go to our link at WGNradio.com or you can visit BillO'Reilly.com. Bill, always a pleasure. Thank you and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
All right. News is next on 720 WGN. Good morning and Happy New Year's Eve to you. It's Dave Plyer in for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN. So from the mayoral runoff, Laquan McDonald shooting, the murder of young Tyshawn Lee, to Governor Rauner, Speaker Madigan, and the stalemate in Springfield, to the Hawks winning the Stanley Cup, the Cubs in the playoffs, Chicago has had a year of headlines. And joining us to break it all down is the man that started his journalism career at Chicago City News Bureau in the early 60s. To over 30 years at WBBM-TV, many with co-anchor Bill Curtis, 13 years at WFLD, his decades of legendary perspectives, which he now shares with our listeners right here on 720 WGN, and that is my friend Walter Jacobson. Walter, good morning and Happy New Year to you.
David, good morning and Happy New Year to you, too, and thank you for having me in. I have a feeling like I'm in your house with all those fabulous historical and antique things you have having to do with the radio.
I'm a radio and TV geek. Right. I can't help myself. I was mentioning to you before we went on the air that back in the 70s, first of all, we opened up with, of course, the classic WBBM opening, which is how I know you with Bill and John Coughlin and Johnny Morris. That's how I got to know you. But in like 1977... we had a family friend who was a camera operator there, and we came to see you do the 10 o'clock news at 10 years old, and I got to sit in your office behind, you know, in front of all the paperwork and all the books where you did your perspective, and I knew at 10 years old how cool that was.
Did I behave myself, or did I try to brush you off? Yeah. I hope not.
No, you were very kind. You were very kind, and I always remembered that. Always remembered that. So much to talk about, and you and I picked, you know, the top five stories, because there's so many of them in Chicago. Let's go back to the beginning of the year, to the mayoral runoff.
Okay, a big, as you say, a big year, a bad, bad year for Rahm Emanuel, which started in the runoff. He really didn't have to get into the runoff. If he had been much smarter leading up to the runoff or leading off to the first primary votes, but he had to get there, and after he did, Chuy Garcia did a pretty good job on him. He did a pretty good job himself, but not enough. I mean, the city at that point, in my opinion, was beginning to divide to a point where it had not been divided before. And Rahm was the culprit.
The days of Mayor Daley just being a shoe-in in a landslide in elections, those days are long over.
Long over, David, because politics is not what it used to be. You know, Daley ran everything. Daley was chairman of the Democratic Central Committee, which means he was the boss of all the precinct captains, and he was the one who, we're talking about Richard J. Daley.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And he was the one who put people in office from local offices all the way up through the state to federal offices. So there was no questioning him. He was the man of power. When his son, Richard M., got in, all of that ended because Richard M. was not much of a politician. He didn't even like politics. He, of course, had not become chairman of the Democrats of Cook County. So, as you say, big difference. And now, Rahm, who's had no experience in local politics other than raising money, in fact, comes from a Washington experience that is not, in my opinion, applicable to what's going on here. Rahm came in like a big shot and acted like a big shot. He controlled the media, still does, or tries to, except at this point, the media is beginning to control him, and he's going to have to find a way to get around us.
So after the runoff and getting back into office, you know, there's been two major issues, and there's been a lot of them obviously related to the Chicago Police Department, and it's the Laquan McDonald shooting. It's the murder of Tyshawn Lee that got a lot of attention. And, you know, I take my hats off to the Chicago Police Department every day because, you know, they are hardworking individuals that risk their lives every day to protect us. And just like in any business, there might be a couple of folks in that department that might not be top-notch or doing the right things. But for the most part, they work really hard, and I take my hats off to them every day.
Boy, I do too. And I, as a reporter, have been investigating police and other activities for, you know, now 30, 40, 50 years, David. And there's always that problem of reporters seeming to pick on police just to pick on them, which I never did, and I don't think that's going on now. The police have, as you say, a tremendously dangerous, awful job, and they're not paid enough money. And whatever they are paid, they have to spend a good portion of it on their uniforms and their weapons. They do not get a fair shake. But, you know, that's politics.
It is politics. It is politics. Now we're at the stage where Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy is now gone. There's a search on for a new police superintendent. Not everyone is calling for the mayor to resign, obviously, with all the protests that have been happening over the last few weeks. This is from Representative Danny Davis earlier in the week. I'm not suggesting that the mayor needs to resign. He said that I'm suggesting that we need to overhaul in a very serious way the culture of law enforcement in our country.
Go ahead. Well, that's what you've got to expect to hear from politicians like Danny Davis and others. I don't think there's any point in talking about Rahm Emanuel resigning unless we do it in some sort of fantastical way. In my mind, there is just no way that man will quit. And I don't think he ought to quit either, because he is the only one in a position now to make these changes, because he's the only one who has that kind of strength. If Rahm Emanuel resigned, and there's just no way he can be forced to resign, there are no laws in the state of Illinois that allow a impeachment by the mayor of Chicago or any community in town, in the state. But he can't do it, David, because he's just constitutionally incapable of doing something like resigning. This is a challenge to him. And if there's anybody anywhere in this city who could make some reforms work, you have to say it would be him.
When I keep hearing protesters and so forth saying, well, the mayor has to go, and I understand that's what protesters do. It's the American way. Then what?
Well, that's it. That's the problem. We don't know what, because what is virtually an impossibility. But I don't think that's a question that we really have to deal with, because he won't. Unless, and no, I won't even say unless. I don't think there's a chance that this man will resign. You never know what these protesters are going to do. And every time something happens that is negative in the city, having anything to do with the police force, there will be these kinds of protests. And the media will latch onto them the way we have up until now. You know, the media in this town, like in others, the newspapers and television, all suffering great financial distress. And that makes us more competitive. That means that there are more reporters assigned to dig into this, more reporters aiming for the big scoop that will be good for their careers, who are trying to find and will go back into the records and find things. And this is what's going to cause Rahm Emanuel serious trouble for the next year. I repeat, not enough to quit, right, but serious trouble. And I don't think it'll stop. So we have no idea what will happen as a consequence if it's not stopping. But I can tell you for sure it's not going to stop.
I have the mayor on my show quite frequently. I like the mayor. I like a strong Rahm Emanuel. I wasn't as thrilled when he gets emotional or tries to get emotional in front of the press. I want to see a guy that's going to go out there and kick some butt.
Well, he certainly is a butt kicker. He was driving, I guess I can say without revealing anything, that he was driving Gary McCarthy absolutely crazy. I wouldn't be surprised if Gary McCarthy was glad to have it over. Now he'll go out and get a great job and make a lot of money. But Rahm was on the phone to him every hour of every day, almost, demanding things that Gary McCarthy, who's a very good cop, couldn't do.
Yeah.
Can't do. Who can do?
Yesterday, the mayor announced some additional overhauls, officer training, including a new policy that calls for every cop on street duty to carry a taser by the summer. He said the policy changes center around de-escalation tactics to reduce the intensity of a conflict or potentially violent situation at the earliest possible moment, emphasizing that the foremost goal is to protect the safety of all involved. To me, that seems like isn't that always the case?
Yeah.
Isn't it, right?
It's almost, you want to say, duh. I mean, why not say that? And, you know, you really can't right now, when all this political turmoil, expect there to be more than that. He's on a tightrope. David, and he can't get off of it. If he makes a change that is tough on the police, then the police will lose faith in him, and maybe they will, as he has suggested, draw into a fetal position and be afraid to act. That's quite possible. That does go on.
I have friends that are police officers, friends that are detectives, and I think that's already happened.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. This is the first time, I think, since Harold Washington was mayor of Chicago, that there is a chance for a coalition candidate in the black community to put that vote together. They were all, and have been since Harold died, they've all been disparate, not interested in the community as a whole politically, but just in their own careers. So they never got together to get a candidate to run for mayor. Now they're working on it. And if you look carefully, you will see that some African-American politicians in Chicago are already jockeying for that race in 2019. Tony Preckwinkle, who's been very critical of Rahm since Rahm got in office.
Yep.
Lisa Madigan was the first politician who went to say that Washington ought to come in here and investigate. She's got an interest in being mayor. Kwame Raoul, the state senator from the south side of Chicago, has already said he'd be interested. They are jockeying behind the scenes to such a degree, we would be astounded if we could sit in on one of those meetings, I would say.
Well, more to come in 2016. Now, stick around. More with Chicago, a year in review with Chicago's very own Walter Jacobson, right after a look at our traffic trouble spots. Dave Player in for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN, and we're talking about Chicago a year in review with our very own Walter Jacobson. So Rauner and the stalemate in Springfield. Rauner pledged to crack down on waste in government in order to save taxpayers over $140 million. He vowed to cut $500 million from the Illinois Department of Central Management Services to find $250 million in Medicaid savings. And Rauner and the Madigan-led Democrats who control the General Assembly are at odds over the governor's pro-business, union weakening legislative agenda, which the governor has made a condition for negotiating a new budget. And here we are. Nothing's happening.
We're into our tomorrow, I think, will be 6 months that the state has been without a budget.
July
1st. And that's just absolutely inexcusable. There were services that were being denied, programs that were not funded. But Rauner has somehow, in talking all this time about cutting back on expenses and not allowing things to go on, he somehow has found money. Who knows where? He's found money to pay the lottery tickets. He's found money to do some, to complete some services, you know, in health and welfare programs. But the budget that was passed by the Democrats that Rauner will not sign until, as you say, the Democratic Party allows more legislation that will cut back the negotiating power of the unions and more legislation that will increase the welfare of the business community. He's not going to sign it. He says now, he's even saying, it may not come until spring. That's just crazy. There are still things that are not being paid. You know, just for example, there are thousands of college students in Illinois who are paying $15,000 to $60,000 a year in tuition, and we're getting some minimal help from the state of Illinois, like $2,300, $4,000 a year in scholarships, and it's just been cut off. They're not going to be able to finish school, so many of them. There are things like that. And Rauner's main problem, if he has one, and I think he does, is that his...
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you...
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Dave Flyer for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN. This entertainment report sponsored by the Captain James A. Lovell Federal Healthcare Center. Happy New Year to you, Dino.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. We're following Steve Cochran, you know, is doing his New Year's Eve shows.
Yep.
Today.
Three and seven.
Yeah. He's actually, he's got them scheduled the same way that Star Wars screenings were on opening day. He did his first one at 4 a.m. today. nice. And then like every 3 hours he's doing.
Wow.
He's the earliest New Year's Eve shows. I think he's on his third one now.
Why is he getting up at 4 a.m. today of all days when he doesn't get up at 4 a.m. for the show?
He's trying to make it available. You know, this is the New Year's show for people who can't stay up late at the Rouse Center. And apparently he's doing shows every hour.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
I'm sure the Rouse Center would be happy to hear me announce this.
I'm sure they will. So are you and I going to be doing what we do every New Year's Eve? We're going to get like a 12-pack of hams and watch Janet Davies and Mark Jean Greco make out?
I got to watch this new Chi-Town, whatever it's called.
Rising.
The worst name ever for an event in Chicago. Only topped by the worst host ever, quintessential Chicagoan Mario Lopez.
Are you talking about you didn't like Saved by the Bell, or did you not find that show entertaining?
I enjoyed Saved by the Bell. Mario Lopez, when I do speaking engagements, and people always ask me who are the worst celebrities to talk to, I'll just say that Mario Lopez is on that list.
Oh, boy.
If you ever attend any of my speaking engagements.
Do you think he's going to stop by and see Screech? Isn't he going to jail just a couple hours north of us here?
Is he really? I thought he was already...
I think it's mid-January.
I've lost track of Screech's jail. Yeah, let me get on that right away.
Yeah, please.
I should be an entertainment reporter following all this sort of thing.
You should. When you were growing up, did you watch Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve? What did you do on New Year's Eve?
I did. We watched, you know what, this is kind of interesting because just recently I found an old cassette. I was going through some old things, and I found this old cassette. Now, for you young people, for all two of you that are under 50 years old listening to WGN.
My kids.
A cassette was... Uncle Dean, what was a cassette? A cassette was a little plastic cartridge that you would pop into a machine, and it played audio.
Played your mixtapes.
It was like your iPod, only 10 times more cumbersome and sounded 100 times worse. But when I was either 12 or 13, I had was given as a Christmas present a portable cassette player. I could not have been happier in my early audiophile years. So that Christmas dinner, I took my new portable cassette player, recorder, to a Christmas dinner at my uncle's house, and I set it in the corner and hit play and record because I wanted to spy on everybody. I wanted to hear what the secret conversations that were going on.
Very investigative.
So, I set it to record, put it in a corner, and, went about my business, and then, later could hear it. But what it recorded was my uncle's watching TV. You could hear a football game in the background. You could hear, my mother talking with, somebody. You could hear us cousins goofing around.
Cool.
And most significantly, you could hear my grandmother, talking to the kids, barking orders at people in the kitchen, and so forth. So, my grandmother's passed away in 1970.
Wow.
I have not to hear her voice after that many years was mind-blowing. Also on the flip side of the cassette, Uncle Dean, you mean you could flip a cassette? And here, something on the other side, yes, you could. On the other side, I recorded New Year's Eve at our house. My grandmother, again, my mother, my dad, and me. My brother was asleep in the other room.
That's cool.
We were playing, the four of us were playing Rummy. That was like a big card game that we used to play in our family. You could hear Johnny Carson in the background. Ironically,
premiering, '60s probably
premiering tomorrow on Antenna TV at 10 PB. I take the most elaborate stories to promote things.
That's fantastic.
But you could hear Johnny Carson ringing in the new year.
Oh, that's cool.
In the background, you could hear when we switched over to Channel 7 and you heard the countdown. No, you know what? I think it was Channel 2 because I believe it was John Coughlin, the weatherman, who was counting.
Ringing in the new year.
Ringing in the new year at State and Randolph. So that's, when I was a kid, that's what we did. We had home parties. And, the family would get together. I get a little taste of some champagne or blackberry brandy. It was crazy.
Ooh, look at you. Ooh. Look at you. See, I remember being sent off to grandma's house so that my parents could have a party.
Yeah, we partied together.
Yeah.
Apparently, my parents liked me better than yours did you.
So, because I got shoveled off like about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, let's get rid of that kid and let's go have some fun.
You mentioned Carson starting on Antenna TV. I remember.
You mean tomorrow night at 10 o'clock?
10 o'clock Central.
You mean that? If only there was a half an hour special I could watch before then.
Hey, when is that going to happen?
I understand that there is a dandy one that'll be on WGN TV. This is where it gets a little confusing.
Huh.
The half-hour special will be on tomorrow. I want to say 4:30. I could be wrong about that.
Incorrect, Reese. Get your team on this.
I might be 100% wrong on that.
100% wrong.
Let me do a quick search on this.
Well, while you're researching that, I remember a Johnny Carson ringing in the new year. It was really late 80s, maybe, early 90s. When he didn't want to go out and do it live, so they taped it, and it was like a bunch of like stick figure people, kind of like in this little shoebox.
Nice.
And he was acting like a reporter from Times Square, but it was all BS. It was fantastic.
That's classy.
Yeah.
So this half hour special is going to be on tomorrow, sometime on WGN TV. I would just leave the station on all day.
Okay.
Eventually, you'll find it. But it will also, the half hour special will also be on at 9:30 p.m., just before the debut of Johnny Carson on Antenna TV at 10 p.m. You'll be able to watch full episodes of Johnny Carson. First time that these shows have been on the air since they were originally, many of them, first time that they've been on the air since they've been on the air. I think tomorrow night's the debut is a 1982 New Year's Day with Eddie Murphy, which I'm sure is hilarious. But it's really cool to see some of these old episodes. And those will be on Antenna TV, which, you know, people have been asking, where can I see the Antenna TV? It's on a free digital channel, 9.2. If you don't, it's on many of the cable channels. But if you don't have those, you can watch it on digital channel 9.2 over the air absolutely free. Get yourself an antenna, and you can watch it for absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I got to get one of those because I've got DirecTV, and I can't get it that way.
Modern technology, this antenna.
Go grab it.
I hear that this whole television thing's going to catch on.
I think
you're technology,
right.
There, people are getting TVs like crazy, I understand. It's the new craze.
Nice.
You're not even going to want to listen to your Victrola anymore after you see this television.
Very nice. And that's tomorrow. Well, I'll tell you what, there's more with Dean after a quick look.
You're not even going to want to listen to Fibber McGee and Molly anymore.
No.
Once you see this new TV and all
this new antenna with all this big antenna thing.
Fancy schmancy technology. Fred Allen is going to be a thing of the past for you.
You did mention also that before that the weekends are going to be the 90-minute episodes, right? So that you'll get like the longer episodes from the 70s and 60s.
Hey, if I don't even know what my half-hour special is on, you think I know that stuff?
All right, we'll have someone look at that here right after a quick look at traffic. Laura?
You can travel Chicago. You'll be calling his name.
You must be very flattered when that plays you back in.
Very much so. John DeCoste, who created that beautifully, tells me he's going to be performing that at Steve Cochran's New Year's Eve show.
Oh, fantastic.
Today at 3 and 7 at the Rouse Center in Crystal Lake. And as long as I'm plugging, Dave, I don't know if you know this, that big half-hour Johnny Carson special.
Oh, is it coming up? What channel is that on?
It's going to be on WGN-TV today at 12:30 in the afternoon.
Okay.
12:30 in the afternoon today, and then we'll be on just before the first full episode of Johnny Carson on Antenna TV at 9:30. No, it's not today. It's tomorrow.
Hello.
I am the worst promoter ever.
You know what, though? I love all the clips you've been playing, and my favorites, as you know, are Don Rickles, man. I love seeing those clips.
You'll see some Rickles in the half-hour special, which is on tomorrow at 12:30 on WGN-TV.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Tomorrow at 12:30, and then tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. on Antenna TV just before the full episode.
So don't bother today at 12:30. We're okay.
No, Johnny Carson, do whatever you want today at 12:30.
Okay.
I hear that Steve Sanders has an especially good protect a pet section.
Oh, nice.
Coming up. So,
12:30. All right. Yeah. Let's stay tuned.
Adopt a pet. Called Adopt a Pet.
Nice.
I am the worst promoter ever.
I don't know how that's possible.
Well, Serious entertainment news for today. Usually this week it's like a desert trying to find you know, an entertainment story this week. But this whole Bill Cosby story, just horrible. I mean, the whole saga of all 50 people that have accused him, horrible. But the arraignment of Cosby yesterday on sexual assault allegation by a former Temple University student who says that she was given drugs and alcohol when she went to visit Cosby at his suburban home. The statute of limitations on this case, this is so interesting, expires on Saturday.
Oh, I didn't know it was that soon. I knew it was January.
Well, it's a 12-year statute of limitation. Wow. It's a long time. But that's how close they did this. How they, made the formal charge against him.
But this was a case in 2004, 2005, and at the time, prosecutors declined to even seek charges because they said they didn't have any evidence.
There was no evidence, but there was a deposition recently that opened up some new information. So the prosecutor there feels like he's got a better case. Legal experts are saying this could wind up being a case of she says, he says. How that gets played out, I do not know. I know that the prosecutor said that he plans on bringing in many of the other women who have made accusations against him to establish a pattern of behavior. So, this story is way not over yet. But it's, Cosby's attorney says that they're going to fight this, that this is groundless, that it's political. This prosecutor is trying to make a political name for himself in Pennsylvania, and that's why he's doing all of this. And they're going to beat this, and he's going to be exonerated in a court of law. So, we'll see what's going to happen.
But here's what I struggle with. I grew up watching the show in the 80s. This was the quintessential show for middle America, middle black America. Such an example, a quality program. Everyone's pulled it off the air. Like, can this show survive on its own as a quality show, or is it forever tainted? Because
I don't know how you watch this anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can watch this show and not think about all, it's going to depend on what happens, of course, but I don't know how you watch this show or see a Cosby in a movie without immediately thinking of all of this. Now, it's still on Hulu. That's a kind of a story today, that Hulu is not pulling off episodes of Cosby from their internet service. Their logic being it's a subscribed service. I mean, no one's putting it on you. You can decide not to watch it yourself, but they are going to continue to make it available.
It's tragic. It's tragic for the people that work behind the show and on the series itself. And again, such an example. But when some of these women have made accusations, they've said that it has happened in the dressing room after the show or on the set of the Cosby Show. That's what I kind of start thinking about, is while this was happening and while he was doing the show, this stuff was happening.
As I've said from the beginning on this, this has to play out in a court of law. It's not that I don't try. There's 50 people, saying the same thing. That's compelling. But still, everyone needs a day in court. Everyone needs a fair day in court.
Absolutely.
Nobody should be tried on the internet. So that being said, it's top stories of the year, and there were a couple of doozies this year. One of them coming in the return of Tracy Morgan. We have some sound of that.
I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm in front of you. I can't believe I'm just here, and just seeing the tragedy that happened, it touches me. Up and down. I have my family. I have my wife, Megan. We're about to be married. And my daughter and my son. So they keep my spirits up. And then I have Ben and Matt Frost and Mark Landsman and all these people that helped me get my spirits up. And Tina Fey and all the people calling me. They just helping me get my spirits up. I mean, the case is settled, but the pain is always going to be there for Jimmy Mack. He's a close friend of mine, a comrade in comedy. And he was a loving man, and he was a warm man.
You can't do that.
Jimmy Mack is the comedian who was in the car with Tracy Morgan when that accident took place. Several others were injured, but Jimmy Mack was the one killed in that accident. But Tracy Morgan, who suffered severe brain injury, many people didn't think he would be able to come back.
Yeah.
Did come back, went back to stand-up comedy, appeared on the Emmy Awards, hosted Saturday Night Live. is doing stand-up comedy tour. So it's been an amazing comeback in 2015 for him.
And funny as ever.
And funny as ever, that's for sure. Nothing funny about the revelation of Charlie Sheen just a month ago.
I'm here to admit that I am, in fact, HIV positive. And I have to put a stop to this onslaught, this barrage of attacks and of sub-truths and very very harmful and material stories that are about the threatening the health of so many others, which couldn't be farther from the truth.
Charlie Sheen talking about his disclosure that he is HIV positive, that he's coming out because he had been blackmailed, said he had paid something like $10 million to people to keep people quiet, talking about this, but just decided to come out and be honest about it. That was a huge story, obviously, for the year.
I'm sure there's some lawsuits coming as well.
There are former girlfriends who have said that he did not disclose his status to them. He says that he did. They are saying that he didn't. So, again, that's going to play out in court. 2015 we're going to look at as being the year for Amy Schumer with her hit movie. She was the it girl in comedy this year. Same with Adele in music. After a couple of years off, came back with her album 25 that turned out to be the biggest album of the year. Star Wars did not turn out to be the number one movie of 2015. It missed eclipsing Jurassic World by only $27 million. Literally, if there were like one or two more days in 2015, it would have beaten Jurassic World. It'll certainly take in that much money over this weekend. But it missed the mark just very slightly in just 2 weeks. The movie's only been out in 2 weeks. But, I mean, the return of Star Wars is...
what a family favorite. I'll tell you, that took me back to the original three. It was a fabulous movie, and I know your reviews, you loved it too.
It was a good one. Also, 2015 marked the 90th birthday for one of my favorites. I know one of yours, one of America and the world's favorites, Dick Van Dyke, celebrating his 90th birthday, and went to Disneyland and was met by a flash mob there, and this was recorded.
That old car.
Oh, that's not Dick Van Dyke. That's not Dick Van Dyke at all.
Do you have that Dick Van Dyke clip? No, we don't have that. Oh. My goodness, I'm so... We were doing so well playing everything today, but I guess we don't have that. Well, but Dick Van Dyke, 90 years old.
Sometimes you just got to read the emails to know what's going on.
But he is not only 90, but married to someone almost half his age, and I'm sure that helps keep him young.
God bless him.
God bless him.
He looks great. He still sounds great. He sang Let's Go Fly a Kite with this flash mob, and it was fantastic. Do we have that sound? It's in the file, I promise. It's in the file. But anyway.
Do you have it? Oh, she's got it. All right, let's take a listen.
Nice. You know, there's all these kids are out there and dressed up like either Julie Andrews or him from the movie and singing Supercalifragilistic or, Chim Chim Cheree or, Let's Go Fly a Kite. And Dick Van Dyke then tweeted, he's very active on social media.
He is.
90 years old. He's very active on Twitter. Said it's great that he can, at his age, he can still go out and play. But no story, Dave. And it's not like we've heard any of it already to have spoiled the big story.
Uh-huh.
Spoiled the big kicker in this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Dave, there was no story that was bigger than one that literally rocked Chicago to the core back in April of this year. Let's hear that again.
That old car might be worth money. Call Victory Auto Wreckers at 860-2000 for a quote.
You know, I'm starting this new thing for 2016 where we do the punchlines of jokes before the actual setups. It's like Jeopardy comedy. where we give the answers before the questions actually come out. But, yeah, this was the year that the famous Victory Auto Records commercial that had been on the air for 30 years, Victory Auto Records decided to change the commercial. Poor old Bob Zameda, the guy who was the truck driver, he used to be a tow truck driver for Victory Auto Records, who, you know, pulls the car door open and it falls on him.
Yeah.
You know, he, you know, went to TV commercial heaven. And
he's not getting residuals anymore.
He's
I
okay.
Heard.
He gets as many residuals as I do for it. actually, I'm about $25 higher than he is.
Nice.
In this whole thing. But they replaced it with an animated commercial. They have now an animated Bob in it. But same old announcer. I redid the commercial for them, so I figure you're stuck.
It's a classic.
You're stuck with me till about 2045.
I think we are.
2045.
I think we are. And you missed one big one too. You know, they announced the Silver Circle in Chicago, and you are going to be one of the inductees in 2016. So now I get to congratulate you.
Yes. I did not know that.
You and Len O'Connor. Are you going to be sitting with Len, by the way, for this induction?
After today's segment, I think I am. Yes, I believe that I am.
Well, congratulations to you and Happy New Year to you as well, Dino.
Yeah, thank you. And don't forget the Johnny Carson special.
When's that airing?
Half-hour Johnny Carson special is going to be on
do you remember?
January 1st at 12:30 in the afternoon. That's on WGN TV. And then at 9:30 p.m. on Antenna TV, where full episodes of Johnny Carson begin at 10 p.m. So 9:30 for the special, 10 o'clock for full episodes of Carson, and then you'll be able to see Carson 10 o'clock every night on the good old Antenna TV.
Looking forward to it, pal.
Have a great day. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. All right, Jenny McCarthy and Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve coming up next, 720 WGN.
What's wrong with being, what's wrong with being, what's wrong with being confident?
Good morning, it's Dave Plyer and for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN. A much cherished annual tradition since 1972, Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve is the top way TV viewers ring in the new year, both in the U.S. and worldwide. Hosted by Ryan Seacrest and also starring Jenny McCarthy and Fergie, the show is a New Year's staple with live performances in New York, along with the iconic Times Square ball drop. The biggest live music celebration in show history features 5.5 hours of music and over 38 performances from Times Square, the Billboard Hollywood Party, and special remote performances from both Nashville and Brooklyn. And joining us on this New Year's Eve morning to tell us all about it is Chicago's very own Jenny McCarthy. Happy New Year to you, Jenny.
Thank you. You too. And you just did my job for me, so thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
That was well done.
Thank you. Thank you. So 44 years of this annual tradition. Can't get any better than that. It's iconic.
It really is. You know, everyone can say that they grew up watching the show pretty much. And I myself remember being able to stay up late with my parents to watch the ball drop with Dick Clark. I never thought in a million years I would be joining this tradition, but I am, and right. I feel lucky being the Chicagoan, you know, and it's my sixth year, and so I'm hoping that I have that same long run as Dick Clark did, and I get to grow old with everybody else.
Right, exactly. I mean, it is a classic. I mean, this is like appointment viewing and watching all the artists on there. I mean, this was, you know, I remember as a kid, I mean, long before MTV or anything else, I mean, this is where you saw some of the top acts of the day.
It really is, and it still is. I mean, the fact that we have 38, you know, the hottest musical performances of the year, biggest songs of the year performing in one night, I mean, it just goes to show you how powerful this show has become over the past 40 years. You know, Demi Lovato will be performing live in Times Square. If you're a country fan, it's a good night for you guys because Carrie Underwood and Luke Bryan are going to be performing in Times Square. So I feel very blessed and lucky to have this job.
Well, you know, in a world where...
I'm scared at the same time.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, in a world, too, where things have been a bit tumultuous and people are, you know, on different pages all the time, and now we're in the middle of a, you know, political rivalry, you know, for the presidency. This is the one moment where you kind of feel like everybody's on the same page. Everybody's kind of ringing in the new year together.
That's absolutely true. And I got to tell you, my very first year doing this, I realize why this is a bucket list experience for people. If you haven't gone down to Times Square yet in your life, you've got to do it at least once, because the energy and the unity and the collective beautiful energy where everyone comes together and the bell drops and the confetti comes down and everyone starts singing and singing New York, New York. There's nothing like it. Like, I literally cry every year because it's so beautiful to see everyone come together in a peaceful way. You know, by 2 o'clock, everyone's, you know, back to hating each other. But at least that few hours, it's utopia.
But you're right, it's surreal. And I lived there for a few years, so I was able to, you know, get rained on by all the confetti and everything. It is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And again, you've been able to do it for 6 years, so that's very, very, very cool. And you mentioned it's Ryan's 11th year hosting, Fergie's 10th year, your 6th year. Again, becoming a tradition for yourself.
It is. And, you know, I kind of look around and go, I hope this is one job I can say out of my 25 years in show business, I hope never goes away, because it's such a treat for me. And it, because it's a tradition for so many people throughout the years and growing up, you'll always remember now it's, you know, Ryan and Jenny hosting New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that this tradition continues forever. For as long as I can speak.
Yeah, me too. No, me too, me too. And again, 5.5 hours of music, 38 performances, 3 separate venues. So the Billboard Hollywood party, you got 5 Seconds of Summer, you got Andy Grammer, you got Fall Out Boy, Macklemore and Ryan.
Brooklyn.
Oh my gosh, it's Nick Jonas, One Direction, Walk the Moon. I mean, it's nonstop. And then Times Square, that's the big one. As you said, Carrie Underwood, Demi Lovato, Luke Bryan. Wiz Khalifa and Charlie, which is going to be very cool. And then you got Jimmy Buffett from Brooklyn.
How cool is that?
Yeah, I know. That's pretty wild. In one night.
I think that might be my favorite.
Yeah, Jimmy Buffett? Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It makes it a lot easier for Ryan and I when we have that many performances, you know, because there's only so many times that Ryan and I can say, wow, look at the street. It's amazing here, you know. So as long as we can bring kind of that kind of musical entertainment always, it's the best show of the night.
And then
New Year's Eve.
And then if you're a Taylor Swift fan, her new video is debuting tonight.
It is going to be debuting. I know. I'm very excited for her and for us. We're the lucky ones that get to see it first.
Weren't you trying to get Ryan and Taylor to make out like a couple years ago? Wasn't that one?
I was so close. I was so close.
They're both single at the time.
I was a girl. Yeah, they were single. And then the next year, he was standing next to Miley Cyrus. And I'm like, you got to just do it. Just plant one on him. Like, I kissed cops the first year. I
yes,
kissed firemen the next year.
Yeah.
I'm like, take one for the team, Ryan.
You bring your hubby down now, though, so that you get to kiss him on New Year's, right?
Exactly. So hopefully we'll be able to make that a tradition every year.
Very
hopefully
cool.
People won't get too bored of that. We might have to change it up.
Change it up by kissing somebody else. I love it. Well, Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve, starring Ryan, Jenny McCarthy, and nearly 40 performances, starts tonight at 7 Central on ABC. It is a must-watch opportunity and an annual tradition. Jenny, awesome. Thanks so much for hanging out with us this morning, and Happy New Year to you.
Of course. Thank you so much, Chicago.
Right, we'll talk soon. Bye-bye. Hey, player in for Steve Cochran. We do something every New Year's Eve. If you don't have plans for New Year's Eve and there are locally owned restaurants that still have some availability, we're going to invite local restaurant owners to call in at 9:50 and tell us a little bit about your restaurant, what you're offering tonight, and how to make reservations. We're going to do that at 9:50 this morning, 312-981-7200. Maybe you can give a gift card to give away to a listener as well. But we're going to do that at 9:50, 312-981-7200.
We get back to the Vulcan planet, and we're confronted by this procession that comes out to meet us, and a very important matriarchal character being carried in a sedan chair. And I'm to greet her, and she's to welcome me back to Vulcan. I haven't been there in quite a while, and we're supposed to say hello to each other. And I suggested to the director that there should be some Vulcan thing that Vulcans do when they greet, like humans shake hands or military people salute each other, Asian people bow to each other. We have rituals. What's the Vulcan ritual on a greeting? And I said, well, how about that? I said, okay. So I did that, and she did that, and next thing I knew, it was in the scripts. Back with the Vulcan salute. You know?
Good morning, it's Dave Plyer in for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN. It's that time of year where we talk about the list of the best and worst of everything in 2015. But it's also a time that we remember and reflect on those familiar faces we lost over the past year. Some are very familiar, some you might not know, but wish you had. And joining me live in the studio, and we've been doing this for the last 4 years on 720 WGN, we welcome pop culture historians Wally Pedrazic and Kevin Picorni. Good morning to you, gentlemen.
Good morning to you.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning to you. There, that we started off with a little bit of Leonard Nimoy explaining what the Vulcan salute was on Star Trek. There's so many to talk about, and some we're going to go over and provide some more detailed background. Others we're going to just tell a little bit about. We're going to categorize them by television, the movies, music, and sports, and those who otherwise impacted our lives. Let's start with television and Leonard Nimoy.
Well, Leonard Nimoy in particular is someone who could have been considered typecast with the role of Spock, but instead he used it, he embraced it at the same time that he put it in context. He turned what could have been a simple, oh, he was that pointy-eared space alien in that one short-lived three-season science fiction series. And instead, that became his jumping-off point to do so much more. And yet, he always respected the character.
Which is rare.
Very rare. Yeah, yeah. And even when he was, quote, distancing himself, like he had a book called I Am Not Spock, okay, you've just reminded everybody about Spock.
Yes.
And it was very conscious when he did that. And so, basically, he used his affectionate association with the viewers and with industry people for Spock to open doors. Spock, though, may have opened the doors, but Leonard Nimoy came in and delivered the goods. He came in and became a director.
He
did many acting roles, which were not Spock, but drew on your awareness
influenced
of Spock.
By, yeah, exactly.
In other words, he played Sherlock Holmes. Very logical, of course. He played in the remake of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He was the one who could pull off the, is he or isn't he an alien? Because, well, you knew he was an alien from his other work. Even further, though, he was a fan of the character and made sure the character was always treated right. So when the Star Trek series was rebooted as a feature film, he definitely was given a wonderful role by J.J. Abrams, in fact, of himself.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah,
and so
yeah.
Instead of saying we are replacing Spock, instead it was we now have two Spocks with Zachary Quinto succeeding him in the same character, but in a parallel world. And I think one of the best and most playful tributes to the respect that Nimoy earned was on 2013. He and Quinto were in an Audi auto commercial, mm-hmm. in which they were kind
that.
Of competing
yeah.
with each other to get to a golf outing.
But again, as you said, always playful with the character.
Always playful, yeah. always yeah. respectful, packed with allusions to his entire career, and ending up with the crossing of real life and fiction by having Nimoy deliver the Vulcan pinch, which would put Quinto flat on his back.
Used to try that on my brother all the time.
I bet you did. And Mira of Stiller and Mira.
You know, it's one of the...
Ben Stiller's mom.
Ben Stiller's mother, yes. And I'll tell you what, it was... you go through doing your research on her, so many questions about when did they divorce? They never divorced. They were married for 60 years, the two of them. They met at an audition. In New York City, the two of them together.
On Ed Sullivan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then she had a recurring role on Rhoda. She was the bartender on Archie Bunker's Place.
She was. Yeah,
she got,
yeah.
It was two Emmy nominations for that. And of course, Dave, you'll remember her on Alf.
Oh, the Elf?
she did. Sex in the City, of course, with her husband, Art Spooner on King of Queens. But what I remember, and you might remember this too, is the Blue Nun commercials. Commercials for Blue Nun. They were hilarious. You know, nobody
That's
was doing
right.
the shtick, and they were so, it was almost like a reality radio commercial. This was like
that.
In the 70s, when Blue Nun started that campaign, they were selling somewhere around 90,000 cases a year. at the end of Stiller and Mira doing those commercials, they were selling 800,000 cases.
Power of their comedy. Yeah. Power of their comedy. Somebody I had a crush on in the 60s and 70s, Yvonne Craig, who played Batgirl.
And you can think of her.
Which is really sad because I don't want to think that Batgirl's gone already.
you can think of her as the first female TV superhero.
Yeah.
She was brought in the third season of the Batman series to boost ratings, basically. But she was also brought in, she thought, because she was a dancer. And because of the stylized nature of the filming of Batman, there were going to be a lot of these pirouettes as part of the fight scenes, smash, pow, crash, bang. But it's sort of ironic that in the same year that she passed, someone who was behind what upstaged everybody else on the TV series, and that was George Barris, who designed, created the Batmobile.
Yeah, he's been at Volvo Auto Museum quite a bit, actually, doing appearances and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's so cool to see that. When my kids even see that car at their age, that is just, it's so iconic. And the Beverly Hillbillies car as well, which brings me to Donna Douglas, who played Ellie Mae, who passed away also.
She's probably our first celebrity to die this last year. She was January 1st. It's hard to imagine Ellie Mae Clampett being 81 years old.
Yeah, I know.
How about this? Irene Ryan, who played Granny at the time of her death, she was only 70.
Yeah, they olded her up for the role.
She was Miss Baton Rouge. She was Miss New Orleans. She starred opposite Elvis Presley, Frankie and Johnny. Here's the one that always impresses me. If you remember the Twilight Zone episode, it was The Eye of the Beholder, where she was wrapped in bandages and she was living in this land of people who had distorted faces.
Yeah.
That was Donna Douglas at the end of that.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to talk more about those who we lost in 2015. And this hour has been sponsored by Wintrust Community Banks.
It's a bold one you are. And who gave you leave to be kissing me?
So you can talk.
Yes, I can. I will and I do. And it's more than talk you'll be getting if you step a step closer to me.
Don't worry. You got a wallop.
You'll get over it, I'm thinking.
Well, some things a man doesn't get over so easy.
Like what, supposing?
Like the sight of a girl coming through the fields with the sun on her hair, kneeling in church with a face like a saint.
Saint indeed.
And now coming to a man's house to clean it for him.
But that was just by way of being a good Christian act.
I knew it was Mary Kay Denner. That was nicer.
That was Maureen O'Hara from The Quiet Man and Miracle on 34th Street. We'll be talking about movies in just a little bit. It's Dave Player in for Steve on 720 WGN. And we're talking to pop culture historians Wally Pedrazic and Kevin Picorni about those we lost in 2015. We were just wrapping up television. Gary Owens and Judy Carn, all from Laugh-In.
All from Laugh-In. Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. Judy Carney, remember, as the Sock It To Me.
Yep.
Girl.
Yep.
You and I were just talking during break that she was married to Burt Reynolds, and that was all of 2 years. Almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of 2 years.
Yeah.
Gary Owens, we probably remember him best from Sesame Street, if you remember. He was always introducing letters and numbers.
Oh, yeah.
That was his gig.
Yeah.
That was fun stuff. But actually, knowing your level of interest, you'll remember him as the Blue Falcon. Remember the Blue Falcon and Dino Mutt on Saturday morning cartoons? That was the voice of Gary Owens. Yeah, man, that was him. He also has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. You'll find it between Walt Disney and your pal Betty White.
Oh, there you go. Patrick McNee from the Avengers.
And I'm going to be able to tie that into Judy Carn as well. Patrick McNee.
Did they date?
Was the dapper John Steed in the Avengers throughout its entire run, 1961 through 69, came back to reprise the role in something called the New Avengers. And in all of these, he was the dapper, in control, quintessential embodiment of British class. And he brought that to just about any role, even when he was supposedly the second to James Bond in A View to a Kill. He had more class than Roger Moore. I respect Roger Moore, but John Steed, a.k.a. Patrick McNee, was controlled whatever scene he was in. Now, I saw him in person, live, on stage at the Schubert Theater in the mid-70s in an Alan Ekberne show called Absurd Person Singular. Patrick McNee was one of the six leads, and Judy Carne was another.
Oh, very good. Very good. There's your tie.
Good tie-in,
nicely
Wally.
Done. Others in television that passed that we'll just mention, Dick Van Patten from Eight is Enough, Roger Reese, who was on Cheers and also a long career on Broadway, Al Molinaro.
Ugh.
Big Al.
Big Al.
Yeah.
Al Del Vecchio.
Yeah,
sure Rosa Coletti's sad at his passing.
Random.
What was Murray's last name on The Odd Couple? There's my
Murray
tribute.
On The Odd Couple.
Come on. Greshler.
I wouldn't have guessed that in a million years. But that's how we first met, Al Molinaro. Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen on Superman. I think it's David Canary, who played Adam Chandler on All My Children for decades. Susan Croft, who played Tracy on The Partridge Family, youngest girl.
Tambourine-slapping girl. She wound up actually got a bachelor's degree. She was working. She owned her own bookstore for a while.
Yeah, she wasn't acting.
No, she got it.
Martin Milner, Adam 12, James Best, Roscoe P. Coltrane from Dukes of Hazzard.
Yes, and he certainly was part of what made Dukes of Hazzard successful.
But long before that.
Yes, exactly.
He had quite a career as well. Marty Ingalls, I'm Dickens, he's Fenster. He's a voiceover artist as well. Dick Van Dyke Show, he was Saul Palmer.
Saul Palmer, right. He was one of Rob's old army buddies. He used to love watching those episodes.
And married to Shirley Jones for years, too. Bud Yorkin.
Bud Yorkin, this coming month in January, is the anniversary of when All in the Family started. And Bud Yorkin was there right beside Norman Lear in terms of bringing that concept, which is a British concept, to
the I remember seeing the name
US.
Always in the beginning of that show.
Exactly.
Bud Yorkin. On to the movies. A little bit, we bumped in with Maureen O'Hara from The Quiet Man. I probably know her a little more familiar from watching Miracle on 34th Street just a couple of weeks ago. But around a long time, in the movies.
Born, actually, in Dublin, Ireland. Get back to that when we talk about Quiet Man. But she did, gee whiz, The Parent Trap, Miracle on 34th Street, Hunchback in Notre Dame, How Green Was My Valley. But for me, I don't know about you, but I know her from the John Wayne movies. She was in Rio Grande, McClintock, Big Jake.
He was more than just a quiet man.
Right. But The Quiet Man, boy, that was something. You know, she was surrounded by her family at her death, and their story is that she was listening to the music from The Quiet Man as she passed. That was that was her favorite. She just...
Do you have a story about Maureen O'Hara and what John Wayne and her said to one another when you were telling me from...
At the end of The Quiet Man, there's a scene where the two of them are sitting out in front of that little cottage in Innisfree, and she leans over and she whispers something into his ear, into Duke's ear. And he turns to her, and there's this look of shock and surprise in his face. And John Ford would do this. He would talk to his actors, actresses about, I want you to say this to him, because he wanted that natural look of shock and surprise. Whatever she said to him, now the story is that she said to John Ford, I can never say, whatever it was, I can never say that to Duke. I would never say that to him. But he got her to say it. And to this day, nobody knows what it is that she whispered to him.
That's
she
wild.
Swore everybody to it. That
That's awesome.
Never know.
Love to hear that. Love to hear that. Robert Loggia, I actually met him a couple years ago. I mean, Scarface, Big, he played on the piano with Tom Hanks. I knew him from The Sopranos.
Exactly, and that was perfect casting in that he had the credibility to play the character of Feach LaManna. Now, the trick here is that he was old school. He was the old-timer who was trying to get back in after prison, trying to get back into operations. And it was really appropriate casting in that you had the young guy, James Gandolfini, as the godfather-like character of The Sopranos, and he has tremendous respect for the old-timer, but he's got to keep him in his place.
Yeah, right.
And so there's this back-and-forth tension, and Loggia pulls it off perfectly, and eventually, instead of being whacked, instead of he...
Which is the respect he had for the older crew.
He had the... Yeah. Instead, they figure out a way to frame him so that he goes back to prison.
Yeah.
And so it is essentially, we respect what you did, I'm not going to disrespect you, but we can't really have you here anymore.
But see you later.
Bring too much with you.
Exactly.
People respect you, and that's a challenge to me, says Tony.
Dickie Moore and Gene Darling. These are not as familiar names,
right.
But Kevin, tell us a little bit about them.
Both, as we would call them, little rascals, but as Hal Roach would call them.
And those we lost in 2015 is what we're talking
right.
about. Our gang comedy.
Lost too, yeah. Our gang. Hal Roach brought Dickie Moore in. This was early 30s. He was working with Spanky, Stymie, and the whole gang. Here's the cool thing about Dickie Moore is that he's stayed in movies for a good portion of his life. He was Shirley Temple's first on-screen kiss.
Wow.
It was Miss Annie, was the name of it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Gene Darling, who was another one of the rascals. She was, my goodness, she's still a holdout from the silent.
The early
oh, yeah.
The 20s,
was,
yeah.
There were 46 silent Little Rascals, Our Gang, that Hal Roach did, and she was a part of that. So she did nearly 50 of those, and some of the talkies too, some of the very first talkies for Our Gang.
Very cool, very cool. Wes Craven, icon in horror, the horror genre,
a maestro. If he did nothing else but Freddy Krueger, he was responsible for embedding his vision into the nightmares of people for generations. But he also did sort of the flip side, the Scream series, which basically made fun of what he himself had begun as his career. He started with something called A Last House on the Left, which he wrote and directed back in 1972, followed with The Hills Have Eyes. And basically, he owned that style of horror, of what we consider fairly modern horror approach. I mean, explicit, scary, but eventually and ultimately with a little bit of a sense of humor.
Now, we're going to cover music and sports as we look back to those we lost in 2015 next, but other movie those we lost, Omar Sharif, Dr. Zhivago, Robert Taylor from Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, Christopher Lee, Lord of the Rings, Alex Rocco from Godfather, and much more. And again, music and sports we'll look at next on 720 WGN. Dave Player in for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN, and we're talking to pop culture historians Wally Podrazik and Kevin Pokorny about those we lost in 2015. That, of course, is B.B. King.
B.B. King. You mean Riley?
Yes.
Riley B. King. It was started out as a disc jockey in Memphis, Tennessee, and he was dubbed, here it is, the Beale Street Blues Boy. And Blues Boy became B.B., and that's how he got his nickname. This is something, Dave. His 15th Grammy Award, and you're going to say, oh, he probably won
15th,
his 15th,
yeah.
Probably somewhere in the 1980s or so, maybe. No. He won his 15th Grammy Award in 2009.
That's pretty cool.
2009.
Yeah.
Later in life, many collaborations. He worked with Eric Clapton, Elton John, Sheryl Crow, Van Morrison, Bonnie Raitt. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Played at the White House for Barack Obama with his buddy Guy. And they performed together, Sweet Home Chicago. They brought the president up on stage for that.
Very cool. Very cool. Ben E. King.
And actually, just to add to that list of supporters, Ringo Starr stopped by when B.B. King did his album, B.B. King in London. And, of course, come to my country. I'll stop by and play drums for you
anytime. How cool is that?
Ben E. King. Just say that name and then just say Stand By Me, and you've got one of the quintessential defining songs of soul. He came from the Drifters, and he sang lead on a succession of songs, Save the Last Dance for Me, This Magic Moment, I Count the Tears, and then on his own, after leaving the Drifters, he had Stand By Me, Spanish Harlem, There Goes My Baby, and this actually relates back. This is my semi-obligatory Beatles connection, because one of John Lennon's last solo single releases before he went into retirement was his cover version of Stand By Me. And his son Julian later did a cover version of that as well. Speaking of things Beatle, a couple of Beatles-related folks, others that we lost this year, John Lennon's first wife, Cynthia.
Right.
Brian Epstein managed Cilla Black, who was a stablemate of the Beatles. They used to compose songs for her. Drummer Andy White, who played on the Love Me Do September 11th, 1963 recording session, to which you say big deal, but actually there were two recordings of Love Me Do, and that was the one that we knew quite well here in the States. And then documentary filmmaker Albert Mazels, who captured their 1964 first U.S. tour visit with a documentary, The Beatles Come to the U.S.
Someone just texted in at 920, please don't forget to mention we also lost my pet hamster this year.
Well, that was nice of him. What was his name?
Oh, that's the name of the group, My Pet Hamster.
Right.
Leslie Gore, It's My Party and I'll Cry If
you
I Want
can.
To.
Yeah, Judy's Turn to Cry, You Don't Own Me, and everybody knows It's My Party. She was actually 17 years old. She was in high school, a junior in high school, and she was signed by Mercury Records, and you might know the guy that signed her. His name is Quincy Jones. And that was the first real hit that Quincy Jones produced was Leslie Gore's It's My Party. Later on, there was an album that went out. It was a tribute album to Quincy Jones, and Amy Winehouse did the remake of It's My Party.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. There was Jerry Weintraub, who managed John Denver, Sinatra, Elvis. There was Percy Sledge, When a Man Loves a Woman, Scott Weiland, who was the Stone Temple's pilot frontman. I think the frontman from Motorhead just passed away. Gary Richrath, who was the REO guitarist. But there was also a recording artist that wasn't necessarily music, and that was Stan Freberg.
Oh, my gosh. Stan Freberg is an industry in and of himself. I mean, anyone who appreciates music, who appreciates humor, and who appreciates the development of pop culture in this century has to love Stan Freberg. Freberg is the one who did parody songs, who was in commercial advertising, so he knew how to write an effective jingle and how to write an effective message. Every Christmas, we hear his parody of Christmas. We hear his St. George and the Dragonet with his parody of Dragnet. He made fun of Lawrence Welk. He made fun of Johnny Ray. Frankly, a person that most people say, Johnny Ray, who's that?
Yeah.
And he did a parody of Johnny Ray's hit Cry, which actually revived interest in Johnny Ray's version of Cry. Because Stan made you think, well, that's pretty funny. I wonder what the original sounds like. Basically, he came from the school of Jack Benny humor. He came from the school of 1940s, 1950s, 1960s radio humor. He saw radio, records, and sound as a palette on which he could do anything, and he did.
Toward the end of his career, he hosted When Radio Was, too, the old-time radio program,
right.
I think,
that's
too,
my
the
favorite.
National
Just
one, right?
Just loved that,
yeah.
Yep.
All right, we're going to cover sports and notable figures after the news next as we look back at those we lost in 2015 on 720 WGN.
Jarvis fires away. That's a fly ball, beat the left back. That's it. Hey, he did it. Ernie Banks got number 500. A line drive shot into the seats and left. The ball tossed to the bullpen. Everybody on your feet. This is it.
Let's go.
Dave Plyer in for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN. And we're talking to pop culture historians Wally Podrazik and Kevin Pokorny about those we lost in 2015. And, of course, that is all about Mr. Ernie Banks.
Mr. Cub, the bump-in was Ernie Banks' 500th home run called by Jack Brickhouse with the Hey Hey. Fantastic bump in there. The only other song that would have made me happier is Hey Hey Holy Mackerel. With him singing it.
Yeah.
Died in January last year, 83 years old. He was an 11-time All-Star. Started playing with the Kansas City Monarchs when he was 17 years old. The coach of the Kansas City Monarchs was the first guy to recognize him, and probably the greatest nickname in all of sports is James Cool Papa Bell. If you would call me from now on, Dave, if you agree with me, cool Papa.
Could do that, yeah.
I would like that. 19 years in the majors and all of them with the Chicago Cubs. He was the Cubs' very first black player in 1953. Was the first player to win the Most Valuable Player Award from a losing team, which he did, and he was the first one to do it back-to-back. And really, I think the only one, isn't he? The only one to have done it back-to-back. Just a legendary icon. How does someone carry the moniker of the team that he plays for? With such a storied past as the Cubs have had, he's Mr. Cub. And what a loss. A bronze statue in front of Wrigley Field for you for life.
Well, and Andy noted that as one of the big sports stories of 2013, along with Minnie Minoso.
Yeah, and Minnie Minoso, kind of the faces of the franchises.
512 home runs. I think he's still sixth, I believe. I'm sorry, way off. 22nd now on that list. He's tied with Eddie Matthews. And I remember as a kid, Eddie Matthews came to Wrigley Field. I think they were probably in their around 60 years old, he and Eddie, and they wanted to finally put an end to the tie. And Eddie was the only one that put one into the bleachers that day. But forever Mr. Cub, and what a story.
Frank Gifford, National Football.
And for Frank Gifford,
Monday Night Football,
and actually, let me put on my TV writer hat here to emphasize as TV historian that he brought credibility to the ABC Monday Night Football. It's hard for us to imagine back in the day with the idea of having a primetime program devoted to football on a major network. That was a big deal. That was a break from the usual spot where you would find football. And he was the one who was the counter to Howard Cosell or Don Meredith. I mean, he was the even-handed play-by-play announcer who could tell you what was really going on. When he was there, he was the rock-solid foundation of that broadcast.
Meadowlark Lemon, Harlem Globetrotters, recent.
Right, very recent. The clown prince of basketball. Is in the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame as a contributor. He joined in 2003. Probably in his own right, good enough that he could have played professional basketball himself and been quite a player and could have created some statistics that we'd be talking about today. But he's more interested in the entertainment end of it, and boy, did he ever. He appeared in more than 16,000 games. He joined the Globetrotters when he was 22, traveled to 100 different countries. According to him, he traveled 4 million miles in his career playing basketball. Wilt Chamberlain was quoted as saying, people would say it would be Dr. J or Michael Jordan as one of the greatest players ever. But Wilt Chamberlain said for him it was Meadowlark Lemon. He started his own. He had Meadowlark Lemon All-Stars. He kind of broke away from Globetrotters at one point. But Dave, knowing your highbrow interest in entertainment, you'll remember him best being part of the Harlem Globetrotters meet Scooby-Doo. I know that's...
You took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, if you don't mention that, how can
I forgot about that.
Think about this guy without, you know, hearing Sweet Georgia Brown in the background and this guy whipping the ball all over the place, a bucket
fabulous.
Full of confetti that he'd throw into the audience, just... Great memories from him.
Classic, absolutely. And then there was Yogi Berra, of course, Baseball Hall of Famer, and, you know, best quotes on the planet, or the most unusual quotes, I should say, on the planet.
Oh, my goodness. It's probably the Yogiisms for which he's most famous. But, you know, a lot of people don't realize what a player he was before that. MVP three times. He was part of 10 world championships. He played in 18 All-Star games. But, yeah, when you get down to it, it's going to be, you know, when you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Yeah.
The Yogiisms, it ain't over till it's over. It's like deja vu all over again. You can observe a lot of things just by watching. And he had said one time, I haven't said half the things that I've said.
That's awesome. Tony Verna, who's not as much of a known character, but this was he was the inventor of the instant replay.
Yeah, and, you know, for a baseball purist like myself, it's, man, you know, now that replay is used actually in the games to overturn calls. It's just that little piece of that human aspect of the game that's lost now. I'm not trying to belittle a guy who's passed away, God rest his soul, but I could do without instant replay in as far as changing outcomes of games.
But it's also become so integrated into the way we watch it,
right,
that we expect when we go to, say, a fancy new stadium that we could look up at the scoreboard and see an instant replay of what we just saw in person.
I'm to the point where I'm at watching high school games and I said, well, that's fantastic, and looking somewhere frantically to find, I get to see this again, right? No, it's you're not going to see it again. We're just used to that. It's part of the culture now.
But part of television history.
Indeed.
Yep.
Yep. Notable figures. We'll go from sports to notable figures. One name you probably don't know, and that's Nicholas Winton.
Yeah, you and I were talking about this, and it, for me, probably one of the most fascinating deaths of this past year. 106 years old. Everybody knows who Oscar Schindler is, and many people have seen the movie Schindler's List, and he was the British Oscar Schindler, though he really didn't appreciate that that nickname later in life. He rescued 669 children from Prague. He's a stockbroker, and he's living in London, and he has this opportunity this one particular weekend. He's going on a ski weekend, and he gets a call from his friend that this is what's going on in Prague. The Nazis are going to come on the assault, and we need to do something about this. He gets to Prague and starts this Jewish refugee program where they're trying to get the children out. It's almost like a sponsorship program. They're sending out trains. He got 8 trains out of Prague. Unfortunately, the final train, which held about 200 children, never made it out. He was knighted by the Queen in 2003. He received Czech Republic's highest honor just a few years back. And just a neat story.
He didn't talk about it.
He didn't talk
Nobody
about it.
Nobody really knew about it until his later age that
his
he was the guy that
came across some books that he had, and it was full of passports and lists of names. And she started asking him about this, and he didn't think it was really worth anything. He actually encouraged her to toss the stuff away. And she said, no, and I want to look into this a little bit more. And it became later on these people reconnecting with him. You know, they referred to himself as Winton's children. You know, there's a great, if you can find it on the internet, this great clip that it's almost like this is your life, but it's the British version of it, where this woman is telling her story about being this Jewish refugee child in Prague, and she tells the story. She gets to the end, and then they announce, turn next to you and meet Nicholas Winton. And the woman has this emotional outburst. Well, then they say, if anybody in the audience considers himself a child of Winton, please stand up. And they had in the audience 50 or 60 people in the audience. It was emotional, very spectacular. What a guy.
Very cool. Very cool stuff. Some other sports, by the way, just texted into, don't forget Moses Malone, Daryl Dawkins, and also White Sox great Billy Pierce.
Yeah.
Who was with the White Sox for quite some time as well. I was called out as a Cubs fan for getting the White Sox players that passed away.
I just got several text messages saying, what about the Sox? But yeah, I think we have our answer.
All right. Fred Thompson, Watergate, senator, actor.
And Fred Thompson is one of the cliches about contemporary society is that Washington is in love with Hollywood. Hollywood is in love with Washington, and Fred Thompson did both. He was a respected senator from Tennessee, and he was also a respected actor in Law and Order. And in his later years, he hosted a conservative radio talk show and became a TV pitchman. And that was probably one of the strangest things is, as you're watching, especially some of these nostalgia channels, which would constantly have Fred Thompson as a spokesperson for a particular product, then you hear that he's passed, go, oh, hey, got to pull all these commercials.
Yeah.
But he definitely was a spokesman and an effective one because he was so respected. He had this air of confidence. And in fact, for a while, he made a run to be president, but then didn't get past the
Are you saying all politicians are actors? Is that what you're...
Yes, and all actors are politicians.
That's correct. Okay. A couple locals, Cardinal George, Francis George, who used to do my show quite frequently, passed away earlier this year. And weatherman for WGN, WBBM, Harry Volkman.
And in both in George's case, it was sort of local boy makes good. And what was most impressive about George is that he said, I'm going to allow for an orderly transition. I see the end of my life coming, but instead of hanging on here until that happens, and then everything's in suspension until that process plays out, instead he stepped aside and let his successor come in. And that was really a respectful thing to do.
There was Mario Cuomo, Don Featherstone, who is the creator of the pink flamingo lawn ornament. I mean, just some random there. Jackie Collins, the author. Forrest Byrd, inventor of the ventilator. Paul Prudhomme, who is a chef. Chuck Williams, founder of Williams and Sonoma. Tom Stenberg, Staples founder. Betty Willis, name that nobody knows. She designed the Las Vegas sign that is so visible, obviously, on anything related to Vegas. Bo Biden, son of Vice President Joe Biden. Bert Shavitz from Burt's Bees. Lillian Verman. So many others, and so many we lost in 2015. And we'll post all of this at WGNRadio.com. Really quick, Wally, you're working on the next edition of your book, Watching TV.
Watching TV. It's now 8 decades of American television, and it's going to hit the stands in early 2016.
Very cool. Wally, Kevin, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
And Happy New Year to you
fun
as
stuff.
Well.
Happy New Year, Dave.
Absolutely. To you as well. All right, so something we do every year here on 720 WGN. If you don't have plans for New Year's Eve and there are locally owned restaurants that still have some availability, we're going to invite local restaurant owners to call in right after this break. So you can start calling in now and tell us a little bit about your restaurant, what you're offering tonight, how to make reservations. And we'll do that at 312-981-7200. You can also throw in a gift card if you'd like for a listener as well. Again, 312-981-7200. We'll talk to you next on 720 WGN. Dave Player and for Steve Cochran on this New Year's Eve morning on 720 WGN. We, as we've done for the past few years, if you don't have dinner plans for tonight, we invite local restaurant owners to call in, tell us what they're offering for the new year. We're doing that at 312-981-7200. First call is Giancarlo from Club Lago in Chicago. Giancarlo, how are you?
I'm doing all right, David. How are you doing?
Excellent. What do you got going on tonight at Club Lago?
Well, we have our regular dinner, so we are seating people until around 8:30, and we are an old-school Italian-American restaurant. We've been around since 1952, Grandpa, then Dad, now my brother and I. And for our New Year's Eve party, that begins at 9:30. It goes till 1:30. We have a huge food spread, open bar, bubbly toast. We have a wonderful DJ. And we're pitching it as a no amateur night because, unfortunately, this often can be amateur night. No amateurs allowed, okay, ladies and gentlemen.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that's all for $85 if you get it ahead of time, or $100 at the door.
Address, website, phone number.
Address 331 West Superior Street. That's the corner of Superior and Orleans. Please call us there at Club Lago. The number is 312-951-2849. And our website is Club Lago, L-A-G-O, clublago.com.
Do you want to do a gift card for our listeners?
I would love to, my good man. Tell me what to do.
What do you want to give, a $25, $50?
I will give a $50 gift certificate to
all
our
right.
great listeners.
All right. We will do that, and we'll actually start asking for those callers in just a little bit. Thank you, Giancarlo, Club Lago
Thank
in
you,
Chicago.
My man.
Thanks, buddy. Happy New Year to you.
All right.
Chris from Hemingway's. How you doing?
Doing great. Happy New Year, Dave.
Happy New Year to you. Tell me a little bit about your place.
Tonight we have a great menu, our full menu. We're celebrating our 15th New Year's Eve here at Hemingway's Bistro in Oak Park. We have openings after 9:30 for our prefix menu, our full menu. We're serving beef Wellington. We have Florida stone crab tonight, live Maine lobsters, champagne, and party favors.
Excellent. And where are you located? What's your address? What's your website?
We are located at 211 North Oak Park Avenue in Oak Park, Illinois. Our website is www.hemingwaysbistro.com with two M's. And you can also call 708-524-0806 for reservations.
All right. You want to do a gift card for somebody?
We sure do. Let's do a $50 gift card to come join us next year and celebrate 2016.
All right. Thanks again, buddy. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Dave.
And a Chicago staple, there's George from the Gale Street. George, how are you, buddy?
Hi, Dave. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Why don't you tell the folks about your place if no one's been there for your fabulous ribs?
Gale Street Inn, located at 4914 North Milwaukee Avenue in downtown Jefferson Park. Plenty of free parking. We have reservations also available after 9:30. We also would like no amateurs, please. That's a nice thought. Love the boys from Club Lago, by the way. Guido and John Carlo.
Yeah,
we got ribs on the menu. You mentioned Chef Paul Prudhomme. We do it. You know, he's the guy that gave us blackened redfish was his famous dish, and we do a blackened salmon that's great. We've got steaks on the menu, lobster and crab legs. A regular dinner menu, no party, no band, no dancing, and that's a good thing.
And that's a good thing.
I will give a $50 gift certificate.
All right.
And Happy New Year to the great city of Chicago.
Thanks, George, at the Gale Street in Chicago. Appreciate it, pal. Have a good one.
Peace and love. Bye-bye.
All right. Edward, you're on 720 WGN. Tell me, it's Fredo's. Tell me about your place.
Fredo's. How are you today, Dave?
Excellent. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We're doing buy one, get one free pizza for everyone who's decided to be a homebody this year. The address is 628 South Roselle Road. The phone number is 847-895-2122. We also have online ordering at fredospizza.com. Again, we're doing free delivery, as we do every day, from 11 o'clock in the morning to 9 p.m. tonight. We were voted number five best pizza in Chicago. And again, buy one, get one free pizza for everyone who's decided to stay home this year.
Cool. You want to do a gift card as well?
Definitely. We'll do $50, sir.
$50. All right. Edward, thanks so much, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you much.
All right. And our last caller, Terry from Pete Miller's. How you doing, my friend?
I am well, thank you. How are you?
Great. Tell me a little bit about what you got going out of Pete Miller's. You got a couple locations, don't you?
We do. We have two locations. Our original location in downtown Evanston at 1557 Sherman Avenue, and our second location out in Wheeling, Illinois, and that's at 412 North Milwaukee Avenue. We are a traditional steak and seafood restaurant, but we do offer live music every evening as well. So tonight at both locations, we will be having live music performing. Evanston will have the Jeannie Tanner Quartet from 8:30 till 12:30 to rock in the new year. She will also be performing from 5 to 8 as a duo. And in our Wheeling location, we have Smooth as Silk taking the stage at 8 and playing until the new year rings in at 12. We have steaks, we have fresh seafood, and all the great traditional sides that go along with those wonderful dishes. We do have some availability early on from like 4:30 to 5:30, and then a little bit later after 9:30. And we'd love to try to fill those spots. So
beautiful. And would you like to give away a gift card to a listener?
Absolutely. We would love to do a $50 gift card to one of your listeners.
Beautiful. Thanks so much, Terry. I appreciate it, pal. Happy New Year to you.
You too.
All right. Before we go, okay, here's what we're going to do, folks. We're going to take the 7th, 9th, 10th, 15th, and 20th caller. We're going to give away $50 gift certificates to the Gale Street Inn in Chicago, Fredo's in Schaumburg, Club Lago in Chicago, Hemingway's in Oak Park, and Pete Miller's in both Evanston and Wheeling. $50 gift cards. Again, we're going to take the 7th, 9th, 10th, 15th, 20th caller, 312-981-7200. Elizabeth Alfano is in for the first half of the Bill and Wendy Show. We'll talk to her next. 720 WGN.